Okay, guys, we are going to get started. So if we can have people take their seats. I have quite a bit of pressure on me tonight. So welcome to the Southeastern RAC. If you have not come before, thank you so much for participating in this public process. If you would like to make a comment on one of the agenda items, there are comment cards in the back. Please make sure you fill out one of those comment cards and you give it to either Morgan or Chris. Okay. All right, so the first item on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion on that?
Make a motion to approve.
Okay, we have a motion by Dana and seconded by Kent. All in favor? Okay. Looks like any opposed. So I have no opposition. And Garish, no.
I wasn't here, so I'm not.
Okay, okay. So Garish is abstaining. Okay.
What happens not.
That sounds good. All right, motion on that.
Motion to approve minutes.
Okay, so I have a motion by Kent Johnson to approve. Do I have a second? I have a second by Eric Luke. All in favor? Okay, it looks like, and then Garish, you're abstaining, correct? Okay, so. Right, so next we have old business, but that's for me. It says old business.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Oh. Are they just talking about me in general? It might be an update from the wildlife board. So, Chris is going to do the update for me. I did not go.
Yeah, so I represented the RAC at the wildlife board meeting. If you remember, our last RAC meeting was about fishing and the guidebook. We had a really quick RAC meeting. It was only 75 minutes long. So I don't think that's going to happen tonight. Sorry. The Wildlife Board had a few motions I might mention. I don't quite understand the background behind this specific motion, but maybe Kevin, if you have some questions, maybe Kevin can answer it. But there was a motion that passed 4-2 that has the division looking into the possibility of designating premium fishing areas that allow artificial lures and flies only, and to have an increased license requirements and fees. So the motion was to look into that idea and bring it back through the RAC and the board at the next recommendation cycle. So it was called an action log item. Periodically the board and the RACs make those motions and give the assignment to the division to look into those ideas, and we explore them and come back and explain what we found. And so that was one motion. The other motion was passed unanimously. It looked at keeping the artificial flies and lure restrictions on UM Creek, the East Fork of the Sevier and Mammoth Creek, and to raise the limit on UM Creek and East Fork of the Sevier to 4 fish. And I think that motion is pretty similar to the motion that we passed here at our RAC meeting. And then the rest of the fishing recommendations were passed unanimously. The Central Region Deer Unit Management Plans were proposed, and we heard those as well. We passed those, I believe, unanimously, and they passed the board unanimously also. And so the board also looked at the Conservation Permit Annual Report and passed that. And that's basically all I have.
Thank you. So next we have the regional update by Chris Wood, our regional supervisor.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. It's a busy time of year. Next week's the holiday. Just quickly go over some things our region's been doing. We've had a busy fall doing some great things. I'll start off with our aquatic section. All these photographs Morgan takes, by the way, these are some great pictures. The aquatic section has been helping our habitat section with the stream restoration project at Miller Creek, which is in Carbon County. I'll go into that in a little more detail in the next slide. They've also finished up the Farron Creek treatment we did two rotenone treatments in that drainage. And then to finish that up, we stocked 49,000 native cutthroat trout back into that system. So that was exciting. If you don't know, this is a fecon head, kind of a bull hog effect there. They're mulching pinyon and juniper trees, probably trying to protect the sagebrush understory that is often thinned out because of pinyon and juniper expansions. So that's what that machine right there is. This time of year, we're working with all of our partners, our federal agency partners and our state partners and our nonprofit and conservation groups to implement restoration, habitat restoration projects on private lands and state lands and federal lands. And so this is just one type of project we do. River restoration and riparian restoration and uplands and high elevation habitat projects as well. We're currently in doing a project at Miller Creek, like I mentioned, with our aquatic section. We're installing these BDAs. They're beaver dam analogs. They basically act as beaver dams would. So they catch sediment. They, they increase the water table so to allow better willow and riparian vegetation growth, and they, it helps reduce the erosion. And so we're doing a lot of work in Miller Creek for potentially introducing cutthroat trout into that system as well. So there's projects going on throughout the region and throughout the state, really, and it's an exciting time. We're flying a lot of seed on, specifically the Trail Mountain Fire. In our warehouse back at in Price, we have pallets and pallets and pallets full of seed that's going to be flown onto that project. But we fly on seed to most of our habitat projects, but that's one of the big ones we have going on. And then, of course, the habitat section manages our WMAs, which are wildlife management areas. And this time of year, a popular activity in our WMAs are the pheasant hunts, which I'll mention here in a little more detail in a second. Our law enforcement officers have been busy, too. If you don't know who that is, I think isn't that Chuck Lawrence? Yeah, Chuck Lawrence, he's our new officer. Lives in Castledale. He covers the south part of the Manti. They're busy, though, of course. They're investigating over 20 deer cases. The bobcat trapping season starts today, and they're also working hunts that go throughout the fall. Upland game, cow elk, bison. They'll be busy for months to come. Morgan, of course, is our outreach manager. Him and Walt do a great job in our region doing different events and writing up media releases and writing blogs and producing videos and pictures. They're also in charge of our walk-in access program, and so we have several walk-in access properties in this region. They're renewing those contracts. We have a big event this Saturday. It's our Mule Deer Watch at Nash Wash, which is in the South Book Cliffs. This time of year, the deer are down in that area very active. And so we've held this event for several years in a row now. And if you're interested in attending that, talk to Morgan or I. We can get you some more details on that. It is kind of sold out, you have to RSVP and it's booked, but we might be able to squeeze you in if you're really interested. So it's a great event, though, where hunters and just wildlife viewers both really come together and admire and appreciate the great mule deer herd that we have here and the ones that winter down near Nash Wash. Morgan's also been busy doing other media projects on the Miller Creek Restoration Project, and then also we have a great project where we're collaborating with the Nature Conservancy on the wetlands in Moab, the Matheson Wetland Preserve, and we're doing a Razorback Sucker Project. So it's a wetland enhancement project that brings in water and helps this native fish and its habitat. So doing some good things. And then finally, our wildlife section. I mentioned pheasants earlier. This time of year, we team up with some of the sportsman groups, and we purchase and release over 10,000 pheasants statewide. I would say 1,000 or 2,000 of those pheasants come to our region and to various properties. They come to Gordon Creek and Desert Lake and our Huntington Game Farm and Fuller Bottom and some of our other walk-in access areas. We have on our website, you can see where we release those pheasants, but it's a really, really popular activity this time of year. That picture of that young man with holding the pheasant was taken just this year, so a few weeks ago when we had our youth pheasant hunt. And so it's become a very popular activity for families to go out and together kind of live like it was, you know, back in the olden days when the pheasant hunt was really popular and there were pheasants everywhere. So we don't quite have those conditions now, so we kind of create that artificial put-and-take type hunt, but it's really popular, and families are really taking advantage of that opportunity. So it's exciting to see. We have our big horn sheep classifications going on right now. Just talked to Wade here. He's flying the North San Rafael. He said in the last 2 days they've counted about 90 sheep. Last year, in 3 days, they counted 101 sheep. So the sheep are looking good in the North San Rafael. I think we'll be doing those classifications the next few weeks and other units as well. And then we'll be heading into the deer classification time of year. And with that, I'll take any questions, and if I can't answer them, I have some biologists in the back that can answer them for you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Now we're gonna have Justin Shannon give us an agricultural contributions to wildlife conservation presentation.
Thank you. My name is Justin Shannon. I'm the Wildlife Chief for the Division of Wildlife, and tonight I'm going to give a presentation on agriculture's contributions to wildlife. the purpose and the background of this presentation is we've been meeting with agriculture pretty intentionally over the last several months, and the idea is to identify and reduce conflicts. And in part of our discussions with the agricultural community, one thing that's come up time and time again is that wildlife, the contributions of agriculture to wildlife are seldom discussed. And last spring we brought forth an informational item on the benefits of the conservation permit program. That was well received. There was a lot of feedback and people saying they learned things that they didn't know before about that. And so tonight this presentation is going to do something similar, highlighting agriculture's many contributions to wildlife conservation. Aldo Leopold, he's considered by many to be the father of wildlife ecology. He said, there are two things that interest me. The first is the relation of people to each other, and the second is the relation of people to the land. And I really like that, because the Division of Wildlife, we value our relationship with the agricultural community. We also value our relationship with the wildlife resource that's on the landscape. Let's see. Talk about private lands real quick. The best lands in Utah were settled early, and they provided exceptional habitat for wildlife. That's still true today. And when you look back, farming and ranching, they were kind of the backbone of our pioneer settlement. Aldo Leopold, he went on to say this as well. He said, there are two spiritual dangers to not owning a farm. The first is supposing that breakfast comes from the grocer, and the second is that heat comes from the furnace. And I really like that, because that's an area that the agricultural community and hunters align. We support the responsibility of our use of our natural resources on the landscape. If you continue on with private land, the rangelands and the cultivated fields that are owned by private landowners, they provide open space and abundant resources for wildlife. And deer and elk are often found on private lands. This last year, we radio-collared over 1,000 elk and deer, and we mapped it on Utah, and so there on the map, the blue polygons are private land. So 21% of the state is privately owned, and the pink dots are mule deer, and the orange dots are the elk distributed throughout the state. What we found is that deer were using 27% of the locations were on private land and 35% for elk, showing that deer and elk have a high affinity for these areas. Moving on to water on private lands. Most water rights are held in private ownership. And wildlife, they need water not only to survive at a basic biological level, but also to thrive. If you look at the contributions of landowners when it comes to water, quality and quantity, they've done a great job with that by developing springs and ponds, wells, troughs, pipelines, etc. This is a big effort that's been done. And in the wildlife, they don't know the boundaries. And so if there's abundant water on the landscape, they're going to use it. And some parts of the state, too, landowners have improved and created wetlands for waterfowl and other wildlife, which has been a great benefit. Some of the partnerships that we've seen from the agricultural community is private landowners often allow access for game and non-game surveys. You know, we'll be allowed access to private lands to classify deer and elk and those types of things, but equally as important is the non-game surveys that helps prevent federal listings and ensuring that we have data to know the distribution and abundance of a lot of the animals on the landscape. A lot of the landowners that we've worked with have partnered with us and Department of Ag and others to improve their habitat, whether it's through the Watershed Restoration Initiative or the Grazing Improvement Program. Landowners allow public access, which has been great, and they've also participated in committees, advisory boards, RACs, et cetera. We've really tried to get their input as we've made management decisions for wildlife. We've said this before, but we'll say it again. The division does not want to grow wildlife on the backs of private landowners, especially when they've reached their social tolerance for how many deer or elk they're comfortable seeing in their fields. Moving on to public land grazing for a little bit. In Utah, these landscapes evolved with herbivory, or the presence of plant-eating animals. And proper grazing practices that can reduce fire-related fuel loads, increase vegetative diversity, improve rangeland health, etc. The permittees, one of their major responsibilities on these allotments is to develop and maintain water system. And as mentioned earlier with private land, same thing with these public lands. That's been a positive thing for wildlife. Last thing I'd say about public land grazing is the permittees, they spend a lot of time on the range, and that's been a good thing. We've been able to get into some pretty good dialogue about what's needed for those ranges. A year like this year where we had a lot of drought concerns, it was good to see what our biologists were seeing and see what some of these permittees were seeing, which influenced a lot of decisions for us and had some good conversations about where we may need to do habitat improvements projects in the future. I want to talk a little bit about some success stories. Alton, CWMU, it's a group of landowners down in southern Utah. They fenced an entire community to prevent depredation for the landowners. It's incredible what they've done down there. They've also conducted numerous habitat projects that have benefited a lot of wildlife species. Jill Ferry, he's a landowner out of Box Elder County. He recently won an award for improving waterfowl habitat on his private lands. He didn't have to do that. He loves wildlife and chose to do it, and loves to see the waterfowl come in, and that's been a good thing. Also, he provides walk-in access areas for sharp-tailed grouse, and walk-in access is where landowners allow hunters to come on their private property and say, well, why is this important? Well, 99% of our sharp-tailed grouse in Utah live on private lands, and so without that landowner tolerance and participation, we wouldn't have access for hunting. Finally, Brad Bowler, he's another one in Hamlin Valley. He's enhanced sage-grouse, deer, and elk habitat on private lands through chainings, water developments, a variety of things, him and his neighbors. It's been good. Managing wildlife is a partnership effort. One thing that we're working with the agricultural community on right now is some horse and burrow-related issues. That's been important, had some good discussions there and some good movement. And responding to drought concerns, especially a year like this year, we graze a lot of our waterfowl management areas and our wildlife management areas, but we don't graze all of them. In years like this, where we had a lot of fires and a lot of pretty intense drought conditions, we allowed permittees to graze some of these properties on an emergency basis. We also increased antlerless elk permits, bison permits, pronghorn this summer because of the conditions. One thing that we're working on is efforts to restore suspended AUMs, offering our support where we can in that effort. Trying to restore habitats and do some monitoring as well. Predator management, the division spends about $1.4 million annually on predator management efforts throughout the state, and that's benefited producers and And also one thing that we've started is a new agriculture and wildlife working group. And this has been a good thing. This is a new group that works together. It's me and Troy Forrest with the Department of Ag. And then we have three representatives from the Cattlemen's Association, Wool Growers Association, and Farm Bureau, and representatives from RMEF, SFW, and Wild Sheep Foundation. And it's been good to to lay issues out on the table and try to give each other the benefit of the doubt and have a better appreciation for the perspective of others, and it's been good. As we were putting this PowerPoint together, the agricultural community, one of the things they kept saying was, the division has some good programs, but we never promote them. We never do a good job of explaining what it is we do. So at their request, we put this together. And I'll be brief on these. I think many here may know some of this, but the first is a cooperative wildlife management units. This is a program that promotes tolerance for wildlife by having open spaces and active wildlife management on private properties. The goal is to allow public access to private lands, and in return, landowners can financially benefit. It's been good. LOAs are pretty similar in that regard. Walk-in access, we talked a little bit about this earlier. Landowners are compensated for allowing public access. And one program that I really like that doesn't get a lot of credit is the Farm Bill program. This is where funds are available to improve habitats on private property. Our dedicated hunter program, last night in the southern region, Kevin Bunnell, the regional supervisor, he shared an experience of some dedicated hunters and helping a landowner and permittee fix fence, fix fence and water pipes throughout the property. And it's been good. Over the last several years, they've built a good relationship and really made some headway in that. And there's a lot more tolerance for wildlife because of these dedicated hunters. Also, the Grazing Improvement Program. This is a program that's administered by the Department of Ag, and we're partners in this. It's to improve rangelands, and in so doing, we benefit wildlife and livestock. Treated about 3.5 million acres. That's the amount that's been impacted on these allotments and other areas since 2006, and this is about a $2.5 million program annually. Our depredation program, this is a big one. It's pretty complex, but to hit the highlights, our agency hazes animals from cultivated crops, provides monetary reimbursement in some situations, provides antlerless permits and vouchers, fencing options, depredation hunts, anything we can within our code and rule and policy to help increase tolerance for landowners. The Watershed Restoration Initiative, we've talked about this a bunch. This is a program that has a lot of partners, sportsmen, federal partners, landowners. There's a lot of players here. And together, we've treated 1.9 million acres since 2005. It's been over 300 million. And the thing I like about it is it works at a landscape level. It doesn't see boundaries. If it's sitla land and it can do good things for forage and improve healthy habitats, great. If it's private land, same situation. But the one thing that's underappreciated is the contributions that producers and private landowners have given to habitat restoration, whether it's in kind, using equipment, donating money, seed, whatever it is. A few years ago, we've provided private land only antlerless elk permits. That was a recommendation we brought before the RACs and boards, and it was approved. And it's been well received. It's built tolerance and provided opportunities for landowners to decide what level of elk they're willing to tolerate on their property. We have general landowner buck deer permits and landowner appreciation buck deer permits. These are permits that if you have private range land or cultivated crops, you can obtain a buck deer permit on general season units. In summary, Elda Leopold, he said, conservation will ultimately boil down to rewarding the private landowner who conserves the public interest. And I agree. We need the help of private landowners in the ag community in order to have the wildlife populations that we do. Wildlife, they benefit from agricultural activities, and we're working together on issues with these new committees we're doing and trying to improve understanding. We have some programs in place to increase landowner tolerance of wildlife, but that's not it. We're actively looking to engage in dialogue and see where we can improve. And at the end of the day, though, this presentation is really about thanking the landowners and permittees for the good things that they've done for wildlife and their habitats, and that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you take questions or?
It's an informational.
Yeah, just informational. No.
Yeah. So.
Okay. I don't have questions.
Just. Either way.
Okay. Thank you.
I think
you.
We've got a long agenda. So.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. So next we have Jace Taylor, talking about the statewide mountain goat management plan.
Okay, thank you for your patience. As I said, my name is Jace Taylor. For the DWR, I'm the bighorn sheep and mountain goat biologist up there in Salt Lake, and I coordinate all the biologists that you have out in the regions, helping work with them and taking care of them with their needs. What I'll be presenting today here is our Utah statewide mountain goat management plan. So this management plan and management plans in general, the statewide ones, they outline what our goals are, our objectives for these specific species. And then we also list off and outline the tools that we want to use to meet our objectives and our goals. And so the process that we go through to make this plan is unique, and I think that it's important for us to understand today. When we do this, we put together an advisory committee, and this advisory committee has people that represent a number of different interests from a number of different communities, a number of different organizations, so the BLM, the Forest Service, Wool Growers Association. We have producers on there. We have sportsmen in the committee, DWR. And so when we do that, we want to make sure that we have everyone's interest involved in this planning process. And then we have meetings through the summer. We had 5 meetings this last summer where we'd sit down for hours at a time and sit and work through the issues and make sure that we drafted the most appropriate plan. And I think we did a good job of that, and I think we were successful in this effort. So, let's see if I can. Just to kind of outline what the plan looks like, first we get into some of the natural history and some of the management that we've gone through here in the state with mountain goats, and then we get into some of the concerns, some of the limitations that they have here in our state, and then from there, obviously, like I mentioned before, the management goals and objectives, and then what tools we use with them. So, as we go through today, I want to highlight some of these most pertinent parts. Highlighting natural history of mountain goats, we've had records of mountain goats here in the state for a long time, going back to the early 1900s and then records through the 1950s. But the majority of the goats that we have here in the state are because of the successfulness of reintroduction efforts or introduction efforts that we've had. We've had 30 transplant events, over 276 animals. And like I said, they've been successful. Now we have mountain goats in a number of different places. And those goats have really proved to be a valuable resource for us here in the state, a great thing for people to go and to observe, a great thing for people to go and to hunt, just a great, unique animal here that we have in the state. And because, like I said, that we've been successful, that's really kind of outlines what we want to continue to do here in the state. One of the charges for the DWR is that we are going to protect and to propagate wildlife species. And mountain goats fall under that. And so our goal is to sustain the populations that we have currently and then find appropriate opportunities to introduce new populations. And so as we do this, one of the important parts of that is to develop unit management plans. You've seen mountain goat unit management plans come to you before. Those are more specific to the individual area and the limitations, the concerns, the needs for that specific area than this statewide plan is. And we'll talk a little bit more about those in the future in a minute. But we also continue to survey them and the numbers, as well as to work on the habitat in those areas to survey that as well. And then obviously we harvest them. That's another tool that we have. And then those transplants that I mentioned earlier are an important part of our management. And in this statewide plan, we have outlined a list of transplant sites You'd see there we have it broken down into augmentations and introductions. The augmentations list includes everywhere that we currently have established populations of mountain goats. And that doesn't mean that we're going to augment all of them. We have even plans to do that. But we want to have that opportunity available to us in case there are unforeseen events that we would, you know, need or benefit from having these transplants. And then the introductions list, I think it's an important thing to note. To get this introductions list, we sit down with all the members of that committee. We get input from biologists, you know, places that they think have suitable habitat. We model habitat for the state. We look at that, places where we could have them. And we get buy-in from everyone in that committee. And it doesn't mean, again, that just because this gets approved here, this meeting, or by the Wildlife Board, that's the last say and that we're going to go out and have plans to put goats there. What we would do is we would go through these unit management plans first. And so what we would do with the unit management plans is that once this statewide plan is approved, we would update all of them so that they would reflect the statewide plan. And then when you would see a unit management plan come to you would be if it falls under one of these four criteria that we have here. So the ones that you've already seen, if there is a significant boundary change to one of those units, then it would come back to the RACs and boards. If there's a population objective change, if it's a new unit, a place where we don't have mountain goats currently, or if it's a situation where we have the goats there, but we haven't brought the unit plan to you in the past. And so under one of those four circumstances, you would see those unit management plans before we did anything transplanting mountain goats. And then all the other plans, if there are minor changes, then they'd be approved by the DWR director. So like I said, these transplants have been successful for us, and we've been successful increasing propagating mountain goats here in the state. And you can see there, this shows the numbers that we've been able to increase them. In the last 5 or so years, we've kind of stabled off. About 1,900 goats is what we have currently in the state from most recent estimates. And some of that stabilizing has to do with populations that have reached their goals, their objectives. Others that have decreased, some that are continuing to increase. But overall, we're happy with what we've been able to do with mountain goats here in the state and really provide a unique animal here for Utahns. And as we've done that, it's been one of the most important things with mountain goats is that we have been monitoring habitat and the habitat they use. Just like any other species that we have here in the state, it's important that we understand the habitat because that's the best way that the most important factor in having healthy and growing herds and manageable herds. And so a lot of that, because mountain goats oftentimes in the state are occurring on Forest Service lands, and then there's some situations where the BLM, you know, has lands where we could have mountain goats. It's important that we continue to work with those, our partners. We've had great relationships so far, and it's been very valuable, and we fully intend to continue to do that in the planning process for those unit plans, any of the transplants, and then here, as we're highlighting with habitat monitoring. In addition to that, we have goals to how we want to provide recreation activities for mountain goats. As I mentioned earlier, the viewing is really a unique situation. It's not everywhere that you can go that you can see mountain goats. And so we want to continue to improve those opportunities. And then also harvesting mountain goats is one of the tools that we have people enjoy to do. The past plan, you look at this top bullet, talks about we want to be able to recommend permits. So this is our biologists looking at their units where they have their herd, and then they recommend the number of permits. It used to be that we did that based on 5 to 15% of all the counted mountain goats that we saw in our surveys, including adults and young of the year. We want to change that to 5 to 25% of the adult population. Making it about adults makes more sense, and then just because different herds, you know, you could have different dynamics or structures of young versus adults. And so we want to make sure we're focusing on the adults, but then we needed to increase that number 5 to 25 to account for that. And that's to make up the difference between going from young of the year to just adults. But also, we want to try to offer more opportunity for hunters that want to get out and hunt mountain goats. There's a lot of demand for them. The yellow line on this figure shows the number of applicants that we're getting, both resident and non-resident, people that are hunting mountain goats. And that red line is the same red line that you saw in the earlier figure. On the other line, because of the scale difference, you could see that it's increasing. But here, because of the demand and how it changes the y-axis, it really changes what that looks like, and it really shows that we're having a hard time keeping up with the demand that we have. And so because of that, changing these numbers to 5 to 25% of the adults increases the ability for our biologists to offer permits. And that doesn't mean that we're going to do that on every unit. There's some units where that's not appropriate, but it does give them that flexibility in places where we want to. We have two types of permits for females. We have a hunter's choice permit where a hunter could harvest either a female or a male, and then we have female-only permits. And these female-only permits are really helpful for us, really important in places where we've reached our population objectives, and it's we don't necessarily want to be doing transplants, and so we need to control the female portion of the population. And so we need to be able to continue to have that tool. And then we also want to look into having a variety of hunting weapons, not just rifles, but, you know, also looking at bows. We want to change, we have the ability to change season lengths or season dates. And the reason for that is we want to be able to offer more opportunity to hunters to meet different needs, and also so that we can be able to offer more permits to help deal with some of the point creep issues that we have. And then one change that that is worth noting, because it requires a rule change, is that in the past, we talked about these two different kinds of permits, right? In the past, we have always required those who have a female-only permit that they take an orientation course to help them identify females from males. We want to change it so that we require that of everybody who gets a mountain goat permit, whether it's either one of the two permit types. And the reason for that is that we've seen in some areas, well, this is statewide, that we have seen those people who have the hunter's choice permits, it's changing so that more and more of them are harvesting females. And so we see the percentage of that harvest that is males has been coming down. This isn't always an issue. Obviously, like I said, we have places where we are totally fine to harvest females, but in some places we think this is limiting the productivity of some of our herds. And so we think this is one way that will help, and it's something that our biologists requested. And so with those tools, we hope to be able to continue to manage mountain goats here in the state and reach our goals for Utahns. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you, Jace. So again, regarding the public process, if you are in the audience and you want to make a comment, please make sure you fill out a comment card and bring it to either Morgan or Chris. But at this point, we're going to take questions from the RAC.
I have a question. With the new units, I understand before implementation or transplants would occur, you go to specific unit by unit management plan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So maybe a good example for everybody here, we have the manti on this list, okay? It's one that we talked about a lot in our committee, spent a lot of time on it, and we recognize that there is an opportunity there. Before we were to put mountain goats on the manti, you know, if and when we work through the issues, yes, there would be a unit management plan that would be put together with input, again, with, you know, specific parties in the area, and that would come to you guys, the RAC and the board, before any of that happened, yeah.
And who would be involved with the unit management plan?
Yeah, so similarly, like we did with the statewide plan, we want to involve all those who have, you know, an invested interest in it in that area. Sportsmen, the federal agencies, of course, would be huge. Producers in the area. You know, those types of folks, and usually we involve the local governments as well in some of those discussions, so, yeah.
Sportsmen's groups,
yeah. I might have missed that one, but yeah. The local biologists would have a much bigger influence on that than they would in the statewide plan, obviously, yeah. Other questions, yeah.
So which units have plans?
Everything in that top part of the list.
Everything that is listed out there.
Yeah, I believe that you guys have seen the unit management plans for those ones that we have established. Populations have been through the RAC and the board process, but none of the ones on the bottom. Okay. The introductions.
Okay, if I have no more questions from the RAC,
I have one more.
Oh, sorry.
With the manti, I see some very some concerns there. The manti is a little different unit than all the rest of them in that there's so much access. Mm-hmm. What type of what do you anticipate for potential for both human interaction and the local? I mean the deer herd, for instance.
Sure.
What kind of an impact do you guys anticipate that the introduction to mountain goats could have on the existing deer herds?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think I'd be happy to answer, but I think that Wade's here and he could probably do the best job of getting into the specifics of that.
Do you want to show the model?
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea.
Greg and I have talked about this a little bit. There is a lot of access on the Manti. There's many ridges and canyons have. Roads and ATV trails. Rusty Robinson, the biologist in the central region, and I last week flew the South Manti from White Mountain to Tent Mountain. It's about 33 miles in length, and the best habitat was on the west side of Skyline Drive, where there isn't a lot of roads in those canyons and basins. A lot different than on the southeast side mountain. And originally, as I've told Eric, I was hesitant about when I first heard about the proposal like a couple years ago to put goats on the Manti because it modeled so well. Once I seen the model, it was pretty undeniable that it models well. It's similar to the Uintas for intact habitat. Of course, there's elevational differences between the two. But flying it, there's potential for mountain goats. But as Eric's pointing out, is that there's overlap in the habitat use of mountain goats and deer. They'll be using the same habitat. There isn't the structure in the cliffs and the on the Manti that there is in other areas where goats are. So they're going to be below the ledges and above the ledges, and so there's going to be overlap. But I think as far as roads and human activity, I think they have places to go outside of those areas.
Would it be fair to say, I haven't seen the mule deer model, but would it be fair to say that the mule deer model would basically be identical or, very similar?
Yeah, on some of those summer areas, it would be. Like we talked about, I think places where it would be different would be, aspen areas that deer are fawning in, and that where goats are not typically going to be.
Okay, thanks, Wade.
Yeah. I think Eric also a little more, from a statewide perspective. All these other places where we've seen our mountain goat numbers increase, over in the recent past, we haven't seen any changes to our deer herds, in those reasons, at least how it pertains to mountain goats. In fact, in some of these places where we have mountain goats on the Wasatch Front, we got great deer herds, deer that have gotten better in the recent past. And it might not be for that reason, but everything that we've seen in literature-wise as well, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of impact. While they might be using the same places, doesn't seem to have a lot of negative impact on the deer herd.
Any disease issues with domestic sheep and goats?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So they can carry some of the same bacteria that we, pathogens that we worry about with like bighorn sheep, for example. That's where we have really high concerns with diseases. And some of those same diseases, pneumonia specifically, they can be affected by those same pathogens, but we do not, we have not, and really not just here in the state, but west-wide, everywhere, or anywhere that we have mountain goats, have not seen the same level of mortality or the same level of issue that we have with domestic sheep and goats.
Any other unit in the state where you're running sheep where you got that high of numbers of domestic sheep or goats, excuse me?
Yeah, no, the Manti would be, you know, the Manti is obviously a really important area for the domestic sheep industry. Anywhere than the same numbers, I don't think I'd say the same numbers.
I mean, do you have where you have herds overlapping?
Yeah, yeah, we have places where we have sheep and domestic sheep and goats in the same areas, yeah.
Can you go back to the previous slide that showed the Manti?
The habitat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the numbers?
Yeah, sorry. So I just barely put this together before I came here. So what we have here on this left image is modeled habitat in orange for a number of areas throughout the state. The ones with the boxes that have the numbers are the places where we have established herds. So going north in Willard. Willard, Wasatch, Nebo, Tushers, Dutton, LaSalle, Uintas, those are where we have these goats. And those are the most recent population estimates. And kind of what I wanted to get at there was, you know, in the Uintas where we have our most, like Wade was saying, our most contiguous, most connected habitat, we've had over 900 goats. And a lot of other places, you know, we have 100, 200 mountain goats. And I think the point there being that, you know, when we go through the unit management plan, the Manti, I'd have to see everyone's opinions and things, but we don't have to have 1,000 goats on the mountain goats on the Manti. It may very well be, you know, one of these smaller ones, as far as, you know, 100 or 200 animals or whatever, you know, it shakes out. But we can have successful herds with lower, you know, lower numbers. So
those numbers would be determined in the unit by unit plans.
Wade and Rusty, the other biologist you mentioned, would be really critical in figuring that out.
I was having a hard time understanding you, but those numbers are current population estimates.
Yeah, our most recent estimates in all those areas.
They have nothing to do with potential.
Yeah. No, there's definitely places in the state where we keep the population smaller than what their potential is for a number of reasons.
So the unit plans is where the population objectives would be set?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I just had a couple questions regarding in relation to some goals and strategies.
Yeah.
One of them is working with the land managers for the goats. So what's the Forest Service view on mountain goats on the Manti?
Yeah, so we had Forest Service representative on the advisory committee, and he doesn't necessarily, he's a forest supervisor, but he doesn't necessarily, they have other, you know, folks that would probably be closer to it. But yeah, he was on the committee, we talked through the issues, and as far as it going on this plan, we all were in the agreement that there's available habitat there, and that the specific issues would need to be looked at closer, you know, in the future. But that it is, you know, it has suitable habitat, and that there is potential to have the mountain goats there. And he was on the committee and agreed that the potential is there. I'd hate to give like a specific, you know, opinion and represent them, but.
Can you tell me where we're at with the introduction of goats in the LaSalle's and the litigation of that?
Yeah, I think. And might be able to do the best job of you know, the specifics there, but
that'd be great. I had to do it.
Or Marty's here too. Marty, yeah, as far as legal aspects, Marty would be the best to get that. We got a treat and have a treat that we have Marty here today.
I'm like a gun.
Maybe the 2 minute version.
2 minute version, Marty. I've got a bet going on, so
if I ever taken too much time. I can't tell you much about how the goats are doing, but the case, as you know, went from the district court filed by Grand Canyon Trust against the Forest Service. The district court dismissed that case on the basis that The Forest Service has never made a final agency action or decision relative to Grand Canyon Trust's request that the Forest Service remove the goats from the LaSalles. It was appealed to the 10th Circuit. Grand Canyon Trust in that had a fairly lengthy portion of their brief that was devoted to the Forest Service in having primary management authority over wildlife. But it all led back to the Forest Service not only has it has authority to unilaterally remove those goats, it has an obligation under federal law. We took exception with that. The state of Utah filed an amicus brief, meaning we're not a party, but it was a brief to the court basically representing its position on wildlife management authority, and the states on Forest Service lands have that authority. 11 other western states joined in that brief, which were really helpful. The case was argued last month in Denver, and none of the questions went to the wildlife authority issue. It was all about the finality of the Forest Service decision and whether there had been a final decision made. And the case is now under advisement with the 10th Circuit.
Thank you. Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, at this point, I will take questions from the audience. We don't have any questions from the audience. We're going to move to comments from the audience. So first, we have Greg Bird from the Utah Wild Sheep Foundation.
Greg Bird, Utah Wild Sheep. I was fortunate to be able to sit on this committee putting together this goat plan and the bighorn sheep plan. It was really well thought out, put together by the division with a lot of different varying and interested parties. We as the Wild Sheep Foundation support the program in whole as presented tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And then next we have Troy Justison. From SFW. Sorry, Troy.
No problem. Troy Justison, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. I too sat on that committee. We support the plan. We put a lot of time and effort into it. I think the key thing to remember is, even though the Manti and some of these other places are listed as possible sites, that it would have to go through and a management plan created to where all the, lack of a better word, affected parties would have the ability to have their input there. Just because it's on there doesn't mean that tomorrow we're putting those goats there. So we would ask that the RAC support this plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. So that's all the comment cards we have for this. So at this point, we have comments from the RAC.
Of course, I have a comment. You know, I am all for expanding hunting opportunities for all species. I am concerned somewhat with manti because it is so different from the other areas. The elevation and the models shows it's good habitat, but it's really the only unit that has a road right on top of the majority of the habitat. Not only one road, but several roads. And the access up there, I see. And then the other big concern I have is, and Jace kind of brought up a fact that in other areas, they have flourishing deer herds and mountain goats. We don't have a flourishing deer herd on this South Manti. Our deer herd is hurting tremendously. And I guess my concern would be that if we introduce mountain goats, that is one more potential factor that could possibly slow the recovery of our deer herd. I'm torn on the whole idea. Like I say, I support the expansion and opportunities, but I do have some concern. The fact that it goes will go to a unit-by-unit management plan, you know, helps ease some of that concern.
We had very similar concerns with the LaSalles, so I understand where you're coming from. Other comments from the RAC?
This kind of goes along with the sheep plan as well, but I'll just say it now. As far as the point creep goes, like the idea of having a few more permits and a few different weapons to be able to go after is great, but I mean, it's like trying to put out a forest fire with a tringe or something. I mean, that point creep's going to eat everybody alive in 10 years, and you know, hopefully everybody stay in good shape, because you're going to be 70 before you get to hunt any of these. So
that is a question. How long before a herd's up and ready to hunt? I mean, can this...
So it depends. I'm trying to think, like for LaSalle's, for example, was it 2013 is when we brought them here, and we're hunting them. This year was the first year. So it took, you know, 5 years or so for that one. I think that's, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. Depends, yeah.
So I have concerns, of course, that mountain goats are non-native species in many of these areas. And by introducing a non-native species, there's numerous unintended consequences to native species and native habitat. I also have a concern that the management plan really is weak on cumulative impacts of multiple introductions of different types of big game animals.
I have a comment too. Looking at the list of the groups that were represented in the advisory committee or board or whatever y'all called it, I can see that it looks like it's kind of stacked with hunting interest primarily. And I don't see the non-consumptive, non-hunters represented on that group. And there are a lot of really good biologists who might have a different perspective on augmentation and introductions. And I would advise the Wildlife Board that in the future to make sure that all voices are heard when you set up an advisory group like that.
Can you say something?
Well, I'd like to make a motion that we pass the WR's proposal for their goat management plan as presented. I think that goats are one of the least impactive as far as other species and things, and it sounds really well thought out. And obviously in the future, we'll go over the unit by unit as it arises. So I think there's a good plan for now, and make that motion.
Okay, so we have a motion by Jay Skyman to pass the statewide goat management plan as presented, and we have a second by Kurt Player. All in favor?
Nine, is that what I got? Do you want to read the who said yes?
Read the opposed.
Okay, so 9 in favor and opposed. And so we have Garish Willis and Sue Bellagamba opposed.
I don't think anybody abstained.
Okay. No. And I would like to note that I think that Garish's comment about once on that advisory board is extremely important. Right. So next we have Jace again presenting the statewide bighorn sheep management plan.
Okay, thanks. So this next is the same idea. It's a statewide management plan. The species here is bighorn sheep. I think we used that, in fact, the same advisory committee and met in the same times. And this committee, I really want to say thanks to all those who gave their time. There's a number of them here, Dr. King and Troy and Justinson and Greg. And, you know, we really have had a lot of support from the folks that came traveling from all the way from the northern part of the state and the southern part of the state, representing a number of different groups. And it wasn't an easy process. And part of that, if you remember back in May, when we brought the Mineral Mountains unit management plan, so remember a specific unit, and we were looking at an introduction, a reintroduction there. It was a tough process. It was, I think this RAC was split, and we had to use a tiebreaker to make a decision, and a number of the RACs were similar, and the board was similar. And what it really did was it highlighted to us that some of the tensions between the agricultural community and the wildlife community were a lot larger or bigger than we had you know, previously understood. And it really helped us to see that there was a lot of concern. And so I really want to thank those that spent the time. We spent a ton of time going through this committee to work through the issues. And so those issues are that there's, again, a high demand for bighorn sheep, a number of parties. You know, they at one point may have been the most common ungulate here in the state, and there's a lot of interest in seeing those numbers to be increased. And that pressure to increase numbers is kind of counterbalanced by there's folks that feel that increasing bighorn sheep also has the ability or the potential to negatively impact people's livelihoods, specifically domestic sheep operators. And a lot of that has to do with some of the things that have happened in some of our surrounding states, that anxiety is a real thing. And so going into this process and all the time that we spent to work through this plan, we had three main goals. So there at the bottom we list basically we wanted to be able to do things that would protect livelihoods of people here in Utah. We also wanted to maintain state management of bighorn sheep, which is important to us as the DWR, but I think to a number of parties as well for a number of reasons. And then also, you know, to make efforts to meet the needs and expectations of Utah's public. And that was not always easy, but I think we got a great product here as we went through. So in ways that we wanted to protect people's livelihoods, it was important to us, the DWR, that we made assurances to those folks that are most impacted. I mentioned domestic sheep operators and grazers, that we showed them that we are not out to negatively impact their livelihoods. That's not our goal. It's not in our best interest. And so there's a number of assurances here in the management plan. A lot of them kind of echo some of the things that Justin talked about in his presentation. And I know it'll take a little minute to read through these, but I want to read through a few of these to kind of highlight what's important. The DWR's objective is to expand bighorn sheep populations where feasible and to maintain bighorn sheep on a sustainable basis. Like I mentioned earlier, that's our charge. This is an animal that's at a fraction of what it once was, and that's our goal is to increase them where it's feasible and where it's appropriate. The DWR does not support any form of involuntary reduction, limitation, termination, or conversion of permitted domestic sheep grazing for the purposes of protecting bighorn sheep. A divide between the agricultural community and wildlife management is detrimental to bighorn sheep conservation and wildlife in general. It's important to us that we're not driving a wedge between us and you know, our constituents, our partners in Utah. DWR supports an active livestock industry that exercises responsible grazing practices. And like Justin mentioned, there's a number of ways that responsible grazing can benefit wildlife and can benefit the range when done responsibly. DWR will not manage bighorn sheep to the involuntary exclusion of domestic sheep. The two must exist in Utah with a proper balance between the two entities. And I think that's what, when it comes down to you guys, is, you know, in the time that you're offering here, you're volunteering, you know, being public servants, public representatives, and that's, you know, the DWR in general, that's our job, and it's important that we find balance and we find ways to help do the most good for the most people. So I think that the language, you know, this is just hitting a few of the high points, but if you look through the plan, I hope that you'll recognize that we've done a lot and come a long ways to provide protection and assurance to those that feel that they'd be affected. As far as maintaining state management, I mentioned that bighorn sheep are at a fraction of what they once were. In fact, when European settlers first came to our state, they may have been more abundant than deer or than elk. There's a lot of cultural you know, art and artifacts and symbolism with bighorn sheep and what it meant to Native American cultures, some that relied entirely on these bighorn sheep. And so they've really reduced, and there's a lot of interest in getting them back, you know, restoring them when appropriate. And the big reason we mentioned it in the, even on the goat part, that bighorn sheep really struggle with diseases, specifically pathogens that are carried by domestic sheep. And the thing is that those domestic sheep, you know, evolved and or were bred in systems where that they were able to manage with those pathogens and those diseases, and our bighorn sheep just aren't capable of that. And that isn't anyone's fault that these bighorns are, you know, are really susceptible to those diseases, but it is a real factor in their decline. You can see that at one point west-wide they were at a fraction, less than 2% of what they once were. Here in Utah we had probably only remnant populations in canyon lands and some of that country with our desert bighorn sheep. But we've made a lot of improvements, you know, both in the West and here in specifically in Utah, to get those numbers to where they are now. But we're still only at, you know, maybe less than 5% of what they once were as far as the estimates go. And so it's important to try to meet the needs of the public, and it's important that we can do that by maintaining state management. And so in this plan, we outline a number of tools that we'll use to reach our goals to manage these animals responsibly. And I'll only hit a couple of them that are down here at the bottom. This is a shortened from what we have in the plan, but I think one that's really pertinent and really that needs to be highlighted is this lethal removal by livestock operators. And what we're talking about there is that there's times when bighorn sheep will leave the herd and looking usually for breeding opportunities, and sometimes they can find domestic sheep, and they do have an attraction. You know, they're closely related animals, and those wild bighorns will go down into someone's domestic sheep, and that's not good for us, because that's when they have the opportunity to contract those pathogens and to carry, and if it can happen where they carry those pathogens back to the wild bighorn sheep herd, and it can have, you know, has the potential to have major negative effects on the herd. And so it's important that when that wild bighorn makes contact with domestic sheep, that it is removed lethally. And so in the past, it's always been done by the DWR, but we recognize that we're not always able to get phone calls and to get there on site in time, and that there are times, specific instances, where it would be valuable to have the livestock operators there who witness the bighorns in with their domestic sheep to lethally remove them for us. And that we believe that has a lot of potential to help us. And so that would be a highly regulated and, you know, outlined restrictive process of how that would happen. And just again, because it gets approved here doesn't mean that next time you hear about it, it's going to be when it's happening. That legal process would need to be outlined with definitions and criteria of how it would be done, the whole protocol, and it would come back to the RACs and the boards before it was enacted. But we do recognize that it has some potential for us and it's something we want to pursue in the future. In our state, as you saw on the previous map, that really we're in the heart of bighorn sheep habitat. We have the two species that we talk about in the management plan. In the northern half of the state, we have Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. In the southern half of the state, we have desert bighorn sheep. There's a lot of potential available habitat. On the right, you can see where we currently have bighorn sheep here in the state. As far as the populations have gone, the yellow line shows our population estimates for desert bighorn sheep. The red line is for Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. Our deserts, as of late, have been continuing to increase. And our Rockies have kind of decreased mass to do with some disease issues that we've had, some of our larger herds. But overall, we've been fairly successful with our bighorn sheep here in the state, and want to continue to do what we can to increase those populations. I think when we mentioned earlier, we talked about the three needs. We wanted to protect livelihoods and maintain state management, and then also try to meet the needs of the public. There's a lot of interest in having bighorn sheep. They're, you know, a really enigmatic, a really, you know, beautiful species and something that's valuable. We want to continue to coordinate with federal land management agencies to improve habitat, and part of that habitat includes reducing the risk of contact and contracting diseases. And then another thing that's important in this plan that we outline is establishing nursery herds. Nursery herd basically just means that it's a herd of a bighorn sheep that we can keep clean. And when I say clean, we can keep free of disease that we can then use that for augmenting or reintroducing other populations around the state. This is an important part of our management as an agency, showing that we can responsibly and effectively manage these animals. So that's really something that we're going to push forward for in the near future. As in addition to increasing viewing opportunities, we also want to increase hunting opportunities like we talked about with the mountain goats, and we'll go over some specifics there, but then also to use transplants to augment or start new populations. In this unit management plan, we also have transplant list, much like in the mountain goat plan. Again, all of the augmentation sites are sites where we currently have bighorn sheep populations. And then the reintroductions, again, working through that committee, working with biologists, looking for places where we have the potential to release, to reintroduce bighorn sheep in the future. And it doesn't mean, again, that just because they're on this list that it's the next time that you'll hear about it is when it's happened already. All of these places on the reintroduction list have limitations or have issues currently. And so they would need to be worked through before we could have bighorn sheep in those areas. This is the list for Rocky Mountain goat or Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, and this is the list that we have for desert bighorn sheep. And again, like we mentioned earlier, we would go through unit management plans before animals were reintroduced in these places. We would use the same criteria: a significant boundary change, a change in population objectives, a new unit where we haven't had the animals in the past, or a management plan for a unit that has not been presented to you in the past. With part of the increase or the improvement of recreation opportunities, hunting of bighorn sheep is another important part of our management and an important part of the process we went through with our advisory committee. We want to also offer more opportunity for people to have the experience of hunting bighorn sheep, and for the same reasons we talked about with the mountain goats, because of the demand and the issues that we have with point creep. So the numbers here, what it used to be was 12 to 15% of counted rams, or 30 to 40% of the rams that were 6 years or older. And so by increasing, changing those percentages there, offers the opportunity for our biologists to offer up to 50 to 60% more permits, depending on the unit. And again, this isn't something that's going to happen in every single unit, but we would find places where it is appropriate, and so that people could have more of that opportunity. And in addition to that, to help facilitate increasing opportunity, we would have used subunits, multiple seasons, season length, season dates, like we mentioned earlier, also weapon types, much like with the mountain goats. Today you're going to hear proposals for archery hunts, archery-only hunts for bighorn sheep, and that's something that we think is important, that we support, and we'd hope you be supportive as well. And then also, much like we mentioned earlier, there are instances where we would want to incorporate ewe hunts to decrease densities, because we talked about the disease issues. Another factor that can contribute to disease outbreaks is when densities become too high, and especially when we have too many animals and then we start to get them wandering. So ewe hunts can help us with that. This figure you recognized from earlier, and just wanted to show the similar idea that we have, the reason why we're trying to find more opportunities for those hunters. The demand is much, much higher than what we're able to offer. Over 50,000 people apply for opportunities to hunt bighorn in this state. And so with all of these tools and with all the work that's gone through in the committee to develop this plan, the plan going forward is we're really happy with what we've been able to accomplish, strengthening our relationship with the agricultural community. I mean, going around to the racks that we've been to so far, you would never even guess that just back a few months ago in May that there was such a divide and that such the issues that we've had. I think we've done a lot to make a lot of progress here, working together, committees, programs. And so we're really looking forward to how we can continue to foster and strengthen that relationship. One of the things that was really big, you remember back to the RACs and the board back in May, was the request for an MOU. So a memorandum of understanding between DWR, between the Department of Agriculture and Food, the Governor's Office, the Forest Service, and the BLM. And so what this would do is hopefully provide protections for domestic sheep operators. And so we've taken that to heart, and with what we have right now is we have a draft of an MOU that is going between those parties, specifically the state entities, and that what it will do is we'll reference this management plan, this statewide management plan, and that those that sign it will be agreeing to manage bighorn sheep here in the state, to work together to implement the plan, managing bighorn sheep as outlined in this statewide management plan. And so that's something that we believe is important, that we look forward to getting working on. And so hopefully once the statewide plan goes through the RAC and board process, that then we'll have that MOU follow shortly after they will getting signed. And with that, with this plan, with that MOU, with the strengthened relationship, we hope that we can continue to, we know that we can continually to work forward, to work together to increase bighorn sheep responsibly where it's appropriate here in the state, and help all those people here, Utahns, that will benefit from it. And so with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that anybody might have.
Okay, so do we have questions from the RAC?
I have a question. In a case where you have a unit that has disease sheep and they have to be terminated, mm-hmm. what is that something that the DWR does? I mean, mm-hmm. I think I see potential there for opportunity for sportsmen to go in to help with that process. Does that actually happen now, or does the DWR pretty much just take care of that on their own?
That's a good question. So in the past, we have had interested hunters that have helped us on with that some, and in the plan here, we outlined that we want to continue to find those opportunities, you know, when there needs to be a lethal action removal, that when appropriate, we can use sportsmen for it. It's tricky sometimes because a lot of these are time-sensitive, so sometimes we can't always get a you know, take the risk of waiting to get somebody else there. But yeah, it is something that we can, that we have and that we outline in the plan. And
I have a question. So this past September, I was down on Zion. I know the north end has a lot of coffin sheep. In a case like that, where you got kind of a big divide between like the north and then you got the park, then the south, like the Canaans, mm-hmm. Could there be like an emergency effort, like pull from sportsmen to get them transplanted out of the south before they're infected? Or is it just kind of let it run its course and see?
No, that's a great question. Yeah, so maybe this is a good time for a little bit of update. So back, what Jason's referring to, back in July, we started seeing coughing bighorn sheep down there in the Zion unit. And at the time, right then, we got working, the park, State Zion State National Park has been great working with us. We started testing animals, we started increasing observation efforts around the unit, and we went through all kinds of different scenarios of what might happen, you know, different options. That was one of the things that was on the table. With that herd, as we watched it closely and we prepared to do whatever we needed to do, the biologists down there, the great thing has been is that we haven't actually seen any mortalities down there in the Zion herd. We had a number of collared animals. As we watched those animals closely, none of them were dying. In fact, we had animals that were coughing back in July and August that have actually, individual animals that are now not coughing. So we're hoping that we dodged a bullet down there. Yes, they do have some of the pathogens that we are oftentimes most worried about, but there are different strains or variants of that, and some are more or less deadly. And so we, from everything we can tell so far, that herd is doing well. But that was a good idea and something that we had on the table that we were watching.
So your big removal on the LaSalle's last winter, LaSalle's unit?
Not LaSalle's.
They brought the chopper in and shot them?
No, so the last time we had a big removal, the biggest one we've had recently was up on the Stansberry Mountains, where we actually did a depopulation. Okay, so on the North San Juan. Last year on the North San Juan, yeah. So what we did there was we went in what we call a test and cull. So when you have a population that's been, you know, chronically and habitually had problems with diseases and they don't seem to recover from them, so kind of the opposite of what we're seeing on Zion, the North San Juan has gone years and years and years without recovering and continually had animals that were sick and dying. What we do is it's called a test and cull. So if this population is small enough, we can go in and catch every individual animal in the population, test them, find those that are actively shedding the disease, lethally remove them, and then it's been shown in other studies and other places that way you can help the herd recover from their issue. And then we also, with the North San Juan, we brought animals in from the Zion unit. Yeah, we've been continuing to watch the North San Juan.
Those were all shot by UDAF out of the chopper.
Yeah, those ones were, absolutely. So that's a time-sensitive, one of these time-sensitive kind of issues where you got to do the removal quickly after you do the test. So we tested them, got results as quick as we could, and did the removal as quick as we could. If we wait, you know, the longer we wait, then things get spread. So it's a good question, though.
Is there a list or a way you could put together a list of interested sportsmen mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
you know, a way you could sign up in the drawing application or something if you're interested in a project like that.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some people you call on the phone, they're not interested in burning their once in a lifetime opportunity on a 130-inch ram.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe somebody else is. Maybe it's a guy that's 85 years old that just wants an opportunity to hunt sheep, and this mm-hmm. gives you, So is that something you've explored, is actually putting that together as a list where people are there and you have a list of people ready made to call that will come?
Yeah, so how we do it, so we take the list already that for the people that have already drawn the permits, and then the alternate list after that, and we go through them in the order. So if it's, we take whatever unit it's within or the nearest unit, and first, if it's before the hunt has happened, then we're going to be contacting those that drew the permits, and we'll explain the situation to them and see if they're interested, and we go through that list, and then we hit the alternate list, you know, for that unit, because we have an alternate list that's ordered in, you know, the order of that they would have gotten the permits had they, you know, if someone were to turn one back in. So yeah, then we hit that list and start going through it until we find someone that is interested in helping us out in the situation. That's the process.
Okay, yeah, that's the current process. Yeah. I was asking if you'd actually...
I think we'd continue to do it that way.
Putting that as a question when you apply for the permit.
Oh.
Are you interested in this opportunity? It may mean having to go on a minute's notice, and then you've got a shorter list of people to have to look at that you know are willing to do it already up front, where it is time sensitive.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think it just... Most people are interested. It just really depends on the specifics of the scenario, you know, when it is, you know, what they're doing that week, the animal itself, you know, where it's at, you know, how old it is, that kind of thing. I think that the way we do it, it works pretty well the way we have it. It can go pretty quick going through the list that we have right now, but it's not a bad idea. But
okay. Any other additional questions from the RAC?
Yeah, can we go back to the list of augmentation and introduction?
Looking for deserts or for Rockies?
Both. Yeah, both.
So there's a desert.
So let me just ask, so as a Forest Service representative, mm-hmm. we're concerned about any interaction of bighorn sheep with the Mexique livestock. Mm-hmm. Are these introduction sites, any of those, we would expect the risk of that being low, I guess. This is for desert. What about for Rockies?
Yeah, so the fact of the matter is we've been trying hard, working hard with the bighorn sheep in the state for quite a while, and to be entirely honest, anything that's on the reintroduction list is there because we can't put bighorns there. We probably would have already done it, and they'd be on the other list. So they all have risks that we have not been comfortable with up to this point. Some of them higher, some of them lower, but we've identified these ones. They have good habitat. There are the specific circumstances in these areas. Recognize that there is an opportunity or a possibility that we could resolve those risks to a point where we'd be comfortable. Some of them are, some of them are higher or lower level of risk, but all of them have issues that we would need to work through before we had animals there.
So if that's a reintroduction, you already have a unit management plan for those?
No, by reintroduction, I mean historically they existed there. We don't have unit management plans for anything on this reintroduction list.
So in that case, you would have to come forward with a unit management plan and recommendation that way?
Yep, exactly. So say, for example, you know, we got the Ogden, we got the Wellsvilles on here. There are issues that we are not comfortable with at the moment. If those were to be resolved, then at that point, we would create a unit management plan. You guys would see it. If everything went well from there, then we felt comfortable, then we could do the reintroduction.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. At this point, I'm going to take questions from the audience. If I don't have any questions from the audience, I'm going to take comments from the audience. So Troy from SFW.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. Had the opportunity to sit on this committee as well. It was interesting to get all sides involved with the ag, the federal agencies, and sportsmen, and to sit down and discuss the issues and come up with some reasonable solutions, and all sides giving some. In an answer to your question on these units, when you're taking into concern that being an issue of contact with disease, I don't know if there's a unit in the state, quite honestly, that isn't have issues. I think we all know that the majority of the units within the state have issues with contact with domestic sheep, And we as sportsmen are willing to live with that. We understand that those domestic sheep are going to stay there and that we support that. But we're willing to, you know, invest the money and the time to grow the sheep, to enjoy them while we can, fully understanding at some point in some time they're going to crash. You know, case in point, guided sheep for 25, 30 years. I drove up the river today. Not too many years ago, you'd see 200 head of sheep driving up that canyon. I've seen zero. But we continue to work to reestablish these herds, you know, for the enjoyment and the opportunity of not only the hunters, but non-consumptives as well. I would ask the RAC to support this plan. Ag, the sportsman, the division, and the federal agencies came together on this. I think it's well put. Is it perfect? No. But we did everything possible we could to protect the operators and to ensure them that, you know, we don't want them off the range. We support the domestic livestock industry, and we're willing to do whatever it takes to show that. So I'd ask you to support this plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Next, we have Greg from the Utah Wild Sheep Foundation.
Greg Bird, Utah Wild Sheep. I'll just echo a lot of sentiments Troy just said. This was a really well thought out and a time extensive process. It was very unique in the fact that we had lawyers sitting in every single meeting. The wording in these are really specific to help with some built-in assurances to the domestic growers in the state that we want to be partners with them, with the Bighorn Sheep and their operations. Our mission statement is we want to put sheep on the mountain. Our mission statement is not to take the domestic sheep off the mountain. So we want to be partners. We want to be good partners all the way around. We felt like this program, this process was really well thought out, and we support it fully. Thank you.
Thank you. And then last, Mike King, representing himself.
Excuse me, I'm Mike King. I was had the chance to be on the committee as well, and the GOAT committee also. And I would just echo what these gentlemen have said. I feel much better about myself today, though, because I also drove up the canyon and didn't see any sheep. So if Troy didn't see any, then it's okay if I didn't see any. But I was impressed with the process that we went through during that time, and especially impressed with how things kind of started off with folks being a little bit agitated that were kind of on opposite sides of the coin. But by the time we got through the process, all of those groups had come together. And I was impressed with the division's willingness to put these committees together and listen to what the agricultural folks had to say, because they definitely have some concerns and reason for that based on what's happened in other places, but also impressed with the sportsmen's groups willing to listen and to work together with that. And I also would like to compliment Jace Taylor for coordinating this, putting it together, developing the plan, and also Blair Stringham, who facilitated the meetings. That meeting process works pretty smoothly when you have somebody that knows what they're doing to keep track of those things. So anyway, it was a good experience for me to sit on the committee, and I support the plan and would encourage you to do the same.
Thank you, Mike. So at this point, do we have comments from the RAC?
I think it's important to note I received a letter, and I assume everyone else did, from the Farm Bureau Administration, and they too conservatively supported the plans.
So if we have no more comments, I will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion. We accept it as given.
So we have a motion by Jeff Christensen to accept the management plan as presented and seconded by Kent Johnson. All in favor? I believe that's unanimous. Thank you. So next we have a presentation by Kobe Jones for Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime.
Good
legs still stiff. It looks like you're walking pretty gingerly.
I don't always make good decisions, Eric, so. Garrick's referring to my wife talked me into running a marathon with her. It was a bad idea. All right. Seriously. Well, with that, I'm Colby Jones, the Big Game Coordinator. I'm here to present the 2019 Bucks Bulls Once in a Lifetime Season Dates, Boundary Descriptions, and a few rule amendments at the end as well. Can I pick this up and just hold it? Does that work? Okay. All right. No, it doesn't work.
But that was fun.
Okay, we'll start with deer. Again, general season deer hunt dates, the archery hunt there first. No surprises here on any of these. Mid-August to mid-September, 28 days, muzzleloader at the end of September there to the 1st of October. The early anti-weapon hunt that we had on several units across the state, this hunt was put in place to accomplish a few things. One, we had units where we had crowding issues that were chronically over objective, and couldn't issue the number of permits that we needed to manage in accordance with the plan. When we implemented this overall, the feedback has actually been really good. A lot of the parents that I've talked to said that when they've had the youth out there, their sons and their daughters, they said that it was a warmer season, it was short, but it worked out. They enjoyed it a lot more. It was a more enjoyable time to be out for a lot of the youth, and they actually really liked it. We also heard from other hunters on the regular any weapon or the later any weapon, and they did notice a reduction in crowding. Also, as always, about 80% positive feedback and about 20%, they got first crack, and that's frustrating. But anybody can put in for it. On to elk, the 2019 recommended general season dates. For archery, a 21-day hunt there, saving the last 7 days for the limited entry hunters. Archery any bull, full 28 days there. The muzzleloader hunt at the end of November, end of October, 1st of November, 9 days, and the anti-weapon hunt there at the 1st of October, 13 days. Now we'll go into changes by region. So starting with the region will be at the top. On the left, we broke it down by species this time, and then the changes for that species within the region. So starting in the southern region with deer, recommending to discontinue the late season limited entry muzzleloader hunt on the Monroe and Plateau Fish Lake units. If you'll remember, a year ago we brought forward a proposal to extend these late season limited entry muzzleloader hunts to all units who are meeting the minimum objectives, and what we heard was a resounding no, follow the plan. Well, to follow the plan, these units have now fallen back in. Now they fell back in, and so the plan says that we remove that late season limited entry muzzleloader hunt. Also recommending to add an early general season any weapon hunt on the Panguitch Lake unit. This is one of those units that has a lot of crowding issues, and this would help alleviate some of that. And recommending to add archery and muzzleloader management buck deer hunts on the Ponsagant unit. This we've been doing on the Henrys. Just provides another opportunity or some different dates for those management buck hunts and other weapon types. On the southeastern region, starting with bison. There's quite a bit here in bison, and we'll just go through this and then explain some of the rationale. But add a cow-only archery hunt on the Henry Mountains, add a new hunter's choice hunt on the Henry Mountains, and then adjust the other bison hunt dates. The rationale behind this is this last year, when we took into account the drought and so everything that was going on there with the habitat and worked to reduce that population to help protect the habitat, we realized that it would help us to have more spots to put hunters in if we had a situation like that occur again. And so that's the rationale behind these additional hunts, and then we'll adjust the other hunt dates accordingly. Also, there's a slight boundary change to the Henry Mountains. This boundary change, if you're familiar with the area,
it takes into account the triangle between the Notam Road and the reef. So before, the boundary ended at the Notam Road, and we'll have bison cross that, and then they're in no man's land. And this takes it all the way to the reef, so that if we have animals cross there, hunters can have the opportunity to harvest those as well. On to pronghorn, recommending to add an archery hunt at the San Juan Hatch Point and a boundary change on the Santa Fe North. This goes across Highway 10 in the area between Price and Huntington to pick up some there, if I remember correctly. For the northern region, with elk, recommending a boundary change on the Cache North limited entry unit to remove the Wellsville Mountains. And then also, that same unit, we're recommending a boundary change to add the Wellsville Mountains to any bull hunt. The rationale here is that the Wellsvilles don't hold a lot of elk. It's not an area where if you had that permit, you would probably hunt. But the limited number of elk that are there cause quite a bit of conflict. Removing that from the limited entry hunt allows us to better deal with the conflict and depredation and other issues that are happening there. Also recommending a boundary change to add the Box Elder Hansel Mountains unit to the any bull hunt. And that change, that area before wasn't in any elk unit. So we have elk there, and it'd be nice to be able to hunt that population. For deer in the northern region, recommending a boundary change to the Cache Extended Archery Unit. This is in an area, largely private land up there, and this helps address some depredation and other conflicts. And for bighorn sheep, to discontinue the Box Elder Pilot Mountain, a Rocky Mountain bighorn hunt. It's Nevada's year. We alternate that permit every other year with Nevada. Under the northeastern region, again, quite a bit in bison here. Recommending to add two Hunter's Choice hunts to the Book Cliffs unit. Recommending to add a hunt to the Book Cliffs Little Creek Roadless. Although the Book Cliffs unit currently encompasses the roadless area, if you didn't apply for a hunt there, you probably wouldn't kill a bison there. Just a lot of work. And so hunters that apply for the Little Creek Roadless area know what they're getting into in advance. And that will also help us manage that population in the roadless. Recommending to add a cow-only hunt on the Book Cliffs unit as well. Other bison hunt dates will be adjusted accordingly to allow for these additional hunts. The bison in the Book Cliffs aren't at population objective yet, but as we approach that, putting these hunts in place will allow us to better manage that population. For deer, recommending a boundary change to the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Unit. On the northeast side, this picks up some agricultural land, and then on the west side, this unit boundary used to split a WMA in half, and so this addresses that. We're recommending that same change onto elk, and we're recommending that same change for elk in the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Unit. The other thing the consequence of that is to recommend a boundary change to the 9 Mile Anthro Limited Entry and Spike Bull Units. So this is on that west side. This adds the entire Cottonwood WMA to the 9 Mile Anthro unit and doesn't split it anymore. And corresponding boundary changes to the South Slope Bonanza Vernal Any Bull unit. For pronghorn, recommending to add a muzzleloader hunt to the 9 Mile Anthro Might and Bench unit and add a muzzleloader hunt to the South Slope Bonanza Diamond Mountain. The central region, starting with deer, recommending to add this. I'll go through, these are a lot of extended archery, and we'll go through what the recommendations are, and then again, like I've done, the rationale, but to add the South Wasatch Extended Unit, to add the Harriman South Valley Extended Archery Unit, to add the Utah Lake Extended Archery Unit, and to add the San Pete Valley Extended Archery Unit. Also, a boundary change to the current Wasatch Front Extended Archery Unit. In Utah County, we have a lot of urban wildlife conflict. Utah County and in Salt Lake County, currently, a lot of these cities that are against this the extended archery unit in Salt Lake, they don't seem to have, they don't have the conflict with deer. Where this currently exists, it was intended to help control populations, and honestly, it's probably turned into more of a trophy hunt. But every day there are hunters out there pushing those deer up into the mountains so they don't come back into the cities. Now, in Utah County and in South Salt Lake, we've implemented an urban deer program, and a lot of these cities are lethally removing these deer. And so they'll go out and under different methods, they'll remove the animals. The division, the pressure's gotten bad enough from the residents, so we issued them a COR that allows them to kind of be the wildlife manager with some restrictions inside their city limits. What we intend to do with adding all this extended archery in these areas is to allow sportsmen some of this opportunity to help solve the problem, allow the opportunity for sportsmen, and not just harvest all these deer inside city limits. For elk, the boundary change for the current Wasatch Front Extended Archery Unit goes for both elk and deer. And I should say that it used to stop at the Utah County, Salt Lake County line, and this takes it down to American Fork Canyon. So it takes in that Traverse Ridge area and some of that. Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep, excited to be able to offer a hunt again on the Oker Stansberry Unit. For mountain goats, recommending a boundary change to the Wasatch Mountains Tippinogus Unit. Also for mountain goats, recommending an archery-only hunt on the Central Mountains Nebo. Some of the key dates, you're getting ready to put in. It starts January 31st and ends on the 7th there. Extended to the 21st if you're just going to buy a point. Lindy will guarantee that all results will be posted by May 30th. The last couple years we've done a better, well, we've been able to get those out actually about mid-May, but guaranteed by May 30th. Quick reminder, there is a season for purchasing and selling antlers, heads or horns of legally taken big game, and that is February 1st to July 31st. Also, here are the season dates for the general season hunt extension dates for hunters with qualifying disabilities. Under the rule amendments, last year we didn't bring it around. A group brought around a presentation on a weapon, a newish weapon, I guess, that uses air to propel a projectile. When they brought it around to all the racks and the board, it didn't seem like there were major concerns. As long as the weapon was restricted to any weapon, it was using a bolt. Nobody wanted to see that in archery or other types of hunts, but as long as it was any weapon, the sentiment was that they were okay with it. With that, we're making a recommendation to adopt that under the following conditions. One, the air gun must be pre-charged pneumatic device from a separate charging device. So it can't be just a pump gun. They use scuba tanks to charge a lot of these to get the pressure necessary to fire the projectile. It has to shoot a bolt or arrow no less than 16 inches. There were some concerns. The energy, some of these guns will shoot a bullet, but the energy, it just isn't there. And also, it must use a fixed or expandable broadhead at least 7 to 8 inches wide and travel at no less than 400 feet per second at the muzzle. Finally, the bottom, and this is key. The bolts, the archery equipment used in the gun would pay PR tax, but the gun still does not. The groups that produce these, the companies that produce these guns have assured the directors of fish and wildlife agencies across the nation that they are working towards having this pay that tax. So as a compromise, in their good faith effort, we felt like we could recommend it as an approved weapon, but ask for a review in December of 2020. And if they haven't made any progress, then we would have to look at that again. Another rule amendment. This helps align us with our surrounding states. The airplane portion of our big game rule was very confusing before. Under certain interpretations, it was wondered if you could even legally fly into the state on a commercial airplane and then hop off in Salt Lake and go hunt somewhere in southeastern Utah. So we decided to clean that up. We looked at several other states in the West and Alaska to see some of the language they had, and this is what we came up with. So the amendments will allow hunters to fly into remote areas. Scouting during the flight is prohibited. And this is one of the things that if you don't think people are out watching, you're wrong. As soon as the hunts start and there's a plane in the air, we get phone calls. And so this will be closely monitored. You must land on an improved airstrip. You can't just land anywhere you want. You cannot hunt until the following day. And then at the end of the hunt, or when you're done hunting, I guess would be a better way to put it, you may transport hunters, their gear, and any legally harvested wildlife back out of the location. And with that, I'll take any questions. Just as a quick reminder, for unit-specific questions that are more specific to the region, we've got the biologist and Guy here. And for anything statewide perspective, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions from the rack.
Do you really think that no scouting when flying is actually
enforceable?
Yeah, thank you.
I think it will be very closely monitored. We have there's a flight school in Cedar City, and because of that, there's a helicopter school, and they do a lot of flying. And our officers say the second the hunts start, they get 2 calls a day on average that they look into. And yeah, I what you're saying, Eric, you know, but all these planes have a tail number. They'll have identifying factors. And I promise you hunters watch this. This is one that, yeah, we'll have to look into it. But I think that the sportsmen and women in the field will be the ones that will help us enforce this.
I mean, it to me, it's pretty difficult because unless a hunter sees them flying back and forth, I mean, if they're going slightly out of their flight path, that's pretty hard to determine if they're scouting or not. If you see them flying back and forth, pretty evident, but.
So as a person who's flown a lot of wildlife surveys, I would say that in order to be successful at scouting, you have to do a lot of things. You have to really drop the speed of the plane or helicopter. And, you know, when we fly a lot of our species, it's doors open on a helicopter. If you don't do those things, if you fly high speed, so you would notice if a plane slowed down, dropped their flaps, and they're just cruising along at 60 miles an hour and buzzing back and forth. Yeah, you're right. They might opportunistically see animals. I would agree with that. But it's pretty tough unless you drop your elevation, drop your speed to actually see what's going on the ground.
You said improved airstrips. What is that?
Improved airstrips. We have a definition in the rule. It's like mechanically, I'm trying to remember exactly the wording. It means that it's been mechanically improved, and it's an approved airstrip. So they're
well, these dirt strips that are private, and it doesn't allow for just landing on these private dirt strips.
I think a lot of those would qualify, yeah, on private.
Obviously, we're still going to have permission on these.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Gravel road, that qualify as
a... I don't think so. No, it has to be for that purpose. Improved. Yeah. Some of us have done this, and some of us, you can put a plane down in a lot of places, but yeah, you've got to have at least some runway. At the end of the day, we had to clean this rule up, and this was one of the best places we got. If we've got suggestions to make it better, we're definitely open to that.
If you were going to improve it, I would say on a private strip they needed some kind of a written permission on. We have two private strips. I mean, I don't know. I guess it just falls right back to trespassing. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Prosecuting for trespassing. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if you were going to add something in there, I don't know if you could, you know, on private strips somehow they need some written permission.
Marty, you're here. What's your take on that? You're welcome for putting you on the spot, by the way. It wouldn't change the trespass laws, but it might just be another feather in the hat.
Okay, so any more questions? Questions from the audience?
Mm-hmm. Bert Burns from LaSalle, representing myself. Can the division touch on baiting of big game, elk and deer? What is the rules?
So we gave an informational on this to the Wildlife Board. Was it in the spring? And currently we allow big game baiting. We're one of the only states. I think there aren't any surrounding states that do allow that, but that Utah currently doesn't have any law or rule against it.
So what is allowed?
For now, we're just talking big game, right?
Talking big game.
There are no restrictions. Okay.
Salt is allowed then?
Yes.
All right. Another question, do we have any rules, regulations for trail cameras or tree stands?
Not in the state of Utah.
Okay.
Any more questions from the audience? So at this time, I'm going to take comments from the audience. We have Verd, representing himself.
Yeah, it's Verd Burns from LaSalle. The reason I'm asking, because of the drought in this part of the state, especially on the San Juan, what we're seeing now is extensive use of trail cameras and tree stands. And because of the drought, everybody's moved into riparian areas. And that's fine, but they are now taking blocks of salt, and you've got salt with the wallows, in the springs, in the stream beds. Cattlemen aren't allowed to put salt within a quarter mile of a riparian area. Sportsmen are doing this, and we need to figure out how to educate the sportsmen, the guides, and the outfitters that we can't be doing this to the resource. I don't know if using the publications for the applications or the rules and guides is a good place to educate them. I did have some pictures. I apologize. They were on the wrong media to show you. But we're destroying the habitat. That is the first thing that we're doing, and we need to change it. Back east, I know that they require ID for tree stands and cameras, I think, but there's no way to identify who owns them. So the land agencies have no way to enforce these laws, except, you know, I don't know how you would do it. Education is the best thing we need to do. Thank you.
Thank you. And then next, Troy from SFW.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendations with the following exceptions. And we'd ask that the RAC vote on these, is bring them forward. One pertains to the southern unit on the Mount Dutton. We would ask that we do away with the late hunt on the Dutton. There is some concern as that's part of the mega units. It winters a lot of bulls from the Boulder, the Panguitch, the Monroe, whatever. And they're on these big mahogany open slopes, and they're really susceptible. And so our concern is the top end on these late on this particular unit is taken off every year, and so we had asked that we do away with that late hunt and bring those permits back into either a mid-season archery muzzleloader or whatever. This was presented at the Southern RAC last night and was passed. The other recommendation has, once again, is in the southern unit, and these next two are totally based upon creating opportunity. And I know there's a lot of scuttle around, and as you get to them, you're going to know what I'm talking about, is what we're trying to do and accomplish with these recommendations is find a way that we can provide an opportunity for people to get out and have minimal impact on the resource, meaning the least effective weapon type at the least effective time. So on this next one, those of you who are familiar with the Boulder unit, there used to be a unit called the Barney Top. It was a standalone unit, and now they've combined it with the Boulder. The Boulder is a giant unit. The Barney Top gets a very limited use. So what we'd like to do is propose creating a primitive weapon unit. And the two hunts that would exist on this unit would be a archery only, and also a primitive muzzleloader. Now, the division made us aware that we'd have to go back and redefine what a muzzleloader is, but what we like as far as restriction on this particular unit would have to be a flintlock, percussion cap, 209, no scope, no sabot. Once again, limiting the effectiveness. Muzzleloaders today, you can buy a muzzleloader right now that is a 600-yard gun all day long. Rifles, we're stretching it now to 1,000, 1,200 yards. So the whole idea is this, is to provide opportunity to have limited effect on there. So it would be the Barney Top unit as a primitive unit. We'd like, you know, we understand we're going to have to do some things to allow the muzzleloader portion of it, but we'd like to create that as an archery-only unit this year. Next of which is, you've seen us come through. This is the third time now as we're proposing a archery-only hunt for bighorn sheep, both desert and Rocky Mountain. To give you a little bit of history on this, is we brought it through 2 years ago. It was passed by the majority of the RACs. We took it to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board says, "That time out here, you ain't got the support of Utah Fennas, wild sheep." So we come back around. We got all the major conservation groups to support it last year. We came back to you last year, presented it to you with all groups. All the RACs supported it. We took it back to the board. The board says, didn't go through the sheep committee. What else did they tell us it didn't do? Didn't go through the sheep committee, and also we'd like a public survey to see what people thought. We took it back again. We took it through the sheep committee. The sheep committee supports this idea. And the main reason being is we got to look at ways, and you pointed it out, there's no way that we can create enough resource for everybody to draw, but there is a way that we can create for at least some people, more people, to experience, to have the opportunity to hunt these sheep, and it's through a less effective weapon type. I'm not married to a bow. I really don't care. I mean, if we want to go to a 30-30 open sights, if we want to go to a slingshot, I don't care. But somehow, some way, we've got to go to a less effective weapon type. So anyway, we're coming back. We'd ask that we have these once-in-a-lifetime bighorn hunts for both desert and Rockies. We had originally picked the Zion and the Newfies, but we'd leave that up to the division to see what unit fits best and would be the toughest hunt with the lowest success rate, and we'd imply in those units in the same way at the season dates. You supported this recommendation last year, and we'd ask for your support again. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any more? Okay. At this junction, you guys are killing me. So can I have a guy representing himself?
Guy Webster, the only thing I'm kind of concerned about is our spike hunt definitely on the Book Cliffs. It's substantially impacted the big bulls up there. For 30 years, we've given about 200 big bull tags. That's what been able to feel like we can sustain. We're killing anywhere from 300 to 400 spikes a year. Math's pretty simple that 5, 6, 7 years from now, there's not that many big bulls to continue that. We talk about point creep. It's substantially causing that to even be more increased. Had to cut back the limited entry big bull tags on the roadless last year. And we continue this trend, we're gonna head up that way even more so. And secondly, you know, I went to the Wildlife Board. I brought forth the proposal last year. Any unit on elk, I think the multi-season tag maybe should be limited to those units that are over objective on elk, but if we got units that are under objective, do we really need to be given multi-season tags? We talk about opportunity. Every one of those tag holders can still have opportunity. He just may have to choose which season he chooses to hunt. With the, you know, the muzzleloader still giving you 9 days to hunt. There's opportunity there, but I think we can also increase opportunity if we're not killing all the spikes to increase our limited entry big bull tags in the future.
Thank you. And then Greg Bird from the Wild Sheep Foundation.
Greg Bird, Utah Wild Sheep. We agree with the plan presented, with the exceptions of the recommendations by SFW. We agree with the Barney Top unit and the doing away with the late Dutton hunts. And we fully support the archery only once-in-a-lifetime bighorn sheep hunts. These hunts, as Troy already stated, are meant for opportunity. And with redoing of the sheep plans, with the going to be increased opportunity just permit-wise, these less effective weapon-type hunts really have the ability to add opportunity. And that's what they're meant to do. If these hunts, or even if they go under 50% success, that's just one more tag we can put on the mountain for that resource. So they're not meant to be 100% success hunt, as most of our sheep hunts have been in the past. It is meant to be a tougher hunt, and it will give us more opportunity. So we do fully support that, and we hope that you'd vote on it tonight and pass it again also. Thank you.
Okay, so that's it for comments from the audience. Kobe, do you mind if I ask you a quick question regarding the archery-only bighorn sheep hunt, just so?
Sure.
Would it add tags to that hunt, or would it pull away from the existing pool?
That's a really good question. The intent would be to do it in a place where we could add permits, with the rationale being that lower success allows us to do that. If we probably wouldn't recommend it on a unit where it was a one for one, obviously, because if it's an any weapon hunt, you can already use a bow. So we would definitely evaluate that and say, no, here it's going to be lower success. And at the end of the day, we can't be 100% sure. But if we don't try it, we'll never know. And so the sheep plan members really wanted it. I'll be presenting on the survey to the board. And I won't give all the details, obviously, but the survey was pretty supportive among once-in-a-lifetime hunters, which tells me that they're concerned about their ability to ever hunt one of these animals, sheep, bison, goat.
And I don't mean to creep. And then my concern with the air guns, not having to pay Pittman Robertson, I mean, I feel like they should pay that tax. But
agreed.
Okay. I'm just going to let it lie.
And when we put in there that we wanted the review in 2020, we mean that's serious. Like, we're not just saying, oh, we'll look at it in 2020. If they're not paying it or making progress towards that, we probably have a hard time continuing to support it.
Kobe, with the archery-only sheep, how does that play into the management plan? I know, as presented, you raised the percentages to where
we can offer more
permits.
It appears
that there will be opportunity for more permits, at least on some units.
We did a couple things in the management plan. One of them was in once-in-a-lifetime hunts, because hunters wait so long to get one of these, we've always had in our management plans that we try to strive for 90% success. And what we heard from the committee was really interesting. It was, stop it. Stop trying to strive for 90% success. There's only a couple ways to address point creep. One is grow populations. Two is harvest lesser quality animals. Or three is use a less effective weapon, right? You can have all the ideas in the world, and it comes down to one of those three things. So
The management plan wanted to do both, Eric, I think is the short answer to that. Mm-hmm. Both provide more opportunity, maybe manage for a lesser quality animal on some units, but also throw a hunt out there that a hunter could put in for, knowing that it might only be 10% success. And that way you assume the risk. Basically, they told the division, stop protecting us. We want to assume the risk. And I said, okay. We said, okay.
Thank you. So let's take comments from the RAC. And at a certain point, I mean, we're going to have to start breaking this down. General comments.
I have a comment. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jason.
I have a quick comment / question for Troy on, so like the Barney Top thing, I understand that two of the best bulls on that unit are down there, so be good to force some people to go hunt over there. But the Dutton thing, being concerned about the unit being top-ended, it's surrounded by Boulder and Beaver, the two premier units in the state. That's where all the best bulls are coming from. And to my knowledge, the only 400-inch bull off the Dutton in the last probably 3 years late season is the one that the governor's tag killed, so that wouldn't fall in the late hunt anyway. I know a lot of people really like that hunt, and there is potential for really big bulls, but it also is only a 15-point draw. It's one of the easier late hunts to draw, so if it's so easy to top end, points would be higher. It is a really rough unit. It's a horseback unit. It's, I think it's a really good late hunt. It's a physical one. It can be easy. There's areas you can drive the road and kill a good bull, but I guess I'm just not quite seeing the reasoning for that on that unit. If you have him comment really quick.
Sure. Is that okay?
Maybe one of the reasons why you're not seeing him, you killed him. This comes from the recommendation comes. I'm very familiar with that. Yeah, that's where I grew up hunting, right there on the Boulder end of Dutton, Johns Valley, there by the old Plegamus Ranch. Yeah, the recommendation actually comes from those locals down there, and talking with Josh Pollock and others, is the concern is you got all these bulls coming from these different units, and you have the ability with those open mahogany slopes with today's technology to put the herd on the top end. Mm-hmm. We'd even entertain the idea of lowering the tags. You know, one of the reasons why we went back into the statewide plan when we developed the statewide elk plan is we didn't want a blanket policy to manage the state is just one way. We wanted to go unit by unit. And there's some units that, and quite honestly, what we wanted to do is develop a hunt structure for those units, and the Dutton is one of them. There's a couple of units that, quite honestly, the late hunt has a big effect on quality. The Wasatch is one, the Dutton is one, and so we'd like to be concerned and take care of that. You know, I know that some people say it's a great, you're right, it is a great, why do they like it? Killing big bulls. But we're just trying to be a little conservative.
Okay, so if we don't have any more general comments, go ahead.
I have one concerning the management hunts, particularly on the Ponsagunt. I talked a little bit with Wade about it, but it's obviously not his unit. I would like to see the division look into extending the length of that management hunt. I think what's happening, my daughter had that tag this year, and so we were down there, and I talked to several other hunters, and I think what's happening, because it's only a 5-day hunt, it's forcing hunters to shoot a younger buck that qualifies as a management buck with the antler configuration, but they're killing bucks that aren't a true management buck. They're killing bucks that have trophy potential because they're so limited on time that they're shooting whatever they can see. The Henrys is a little tougher because you have the bison hunt that would, you know, conflict with lengthening that season out. But to my knowledge, there's not another hunt on the Ponsagunt, the cactus hunt, but honestly, those two hunts could run together and coincide, and I know the division doesn't like to see hunts in the rut, but actually that's a prime opportunity to have these hunters take to target animals rather than just a younger buck that qualifies.
Okay, so unless we want to general comment, or do you want to?
General comment.
Okay.
Going back to the point creep, there is the fourth option that eventually will probably have to be done, and I understand it, it's not going to be popular, but it's going to have to be restructured for some of these once in a lifetime, and your San Juan Bowl, your Henry's, because it legitimately is going to be the point in 10, 20 years where, like, you're looking at 80-plus-year-old people. And I guess then it maybe won't be a problem because the hunter success rate will be lower because they can't get out of the truck.
So I think what we should do is, if there are individual motions that we want to make, we should make those now, unless we want to accept the whole proposal as presented. If we want to do individual motions, we can start breaking them down.
Just before we get into that, I do have a question. I mean, it was brought up about people using salt blocks too close to water, and there is the regulation placed on livestock growers. They have to stay a quarter of a mile away from live water with their salt. Who has oversight? Is that there's probably oversight. Doesn't that rule also cover anybody that's hunting?
Yeah, I think we discussed this a few years ago with the Forest Service specifically, and I think we decided it was the Forest Service land management. They had the jurisdiction and the authority to put up regulations or try to.
Yeah, our challenge is with livestock, they're permitted, so we have some say in what they do. The general public, that's a harder issue for us. And I do believe this individual has a good point. I mean, we've struggled with that, and that is a concern. We regulate livestock operators, but we don't.
Well, so Verd's point.
That might be something that the division can place in the proclamations and in the rules as an information thing, like saying, you know, it is federal regulation that we keep any salt licks minimum quarter mile away from live water.
Although I don't know that it is, correct? I mean, is
well,
that?
Well, it is on livestock operators.
Yeah, livestock operators. I don't know. I can't remember. There's
everybody else.
There's a distance. I don't know if it's quite a quarter mile, but there's a distance off water. 150 yards, I can't remember, but there is a distance that they do not salt near water.
Is there a reason they're still allowing the baiting? I'm kind of new on this. I don't really understand it. I mean, you're having to register a bait on a bear, correct, still?
Yeah.
Why are we not registering a bait on a deer? I mean,
It's been discussed at length. I think you get there's all kinds of things you discuss. What's the definition of baiting? Some of the agriculture community actually likes to bait because they draw in animals and make money off animals they can draw in. And so it's been discussed at great length over the years, and it's something that the RAC and the boards have decided not to regulate. So that's my understanding.
It's a tough one. I mean, I don't want to have there are a lot of ins and outs. Baiting has a lot of unintended consequences.
Well, has it ever come up as an action item?
Absolutely. The board asked us to present an informational on it, and we did. And what we said is we'll look at this as we go through the mule deer management plan, I think, because it's a huge issue. There are a lot of factors to consider. You know, you're mentioning habitat. We also have, in the state of Utah, we have people who make their livelihood selling baits, selling salts. We have private landowners in the northern part that, for wildlife, run CWMUs, and baiting is a big part of their agricultural business for wildlife. So it's not just black and white. And when we draw the line, it probably will be black and white. And it'll affect private landowners, it'll affect public land hunters, and so it's a tough one. It'll affect livelihoods. It's a hard one to draw, and And we're not saying we're not willing to go down there and draw the line, because it also has some pretty serious consequences.
Cattle, it has to be an approved salting site, correct? I know the allotments I've ran on, it has to be an approved site. You can't just go dump that anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, we encourage not put it near a gate or a trough, put them over here. We don't exactly specify this spot, but we give some direction.
Since I was involved in the Forest Service, because it was you had to do this site. So I'm just curious why there's no restrictions at all on when it comes to the wildlife. Because there is on the bear. I mean, you have to register your bait with a bear.
We're talking at a very different scale with different reasons. You know, we're talking 92,000 deer hunters versus, I don't know how many bait stations we have in the state, maybe 700. But your point is well taken in that it's an issue.
I mean, I don't really have a dog in the fight. I'm just asking a question.
No.
I think to register baits would create a huge issue for the division, because there are so many sportsmen out there, and they're not putting out one or two cameras. I know some of these outfitters that put out 60 to 100 cameras. And so what it would take to register those, each site, they'd have to probably hire full-time positions just to monitor that alone. So it is a tough situation, but I think there could be some verbiage put in the proclamation that, you know, how enforceable it is yet to be seen, but at least it would encourage and make sportsmen aware that they need to be mindful of where they're placing.
Agreed, and not to step in again, but Jeff, you're right. Eventually, this is it. Baiting wasn't typical in Western hunting. We just as Western hunters, we just didn't do it, and it's become more and more popular over the years. And that's probably why it was never addressed, is because it didn't work very well. But that's not the case anymore. And the further south you go in the state, probably the more it happens on public land, for sure. It's an issue, and it needs to be addressed. Education is probably a good place to start.
I just have two comments along that same line that haven't been mentioned as far as the baiting, but I'm sure, you know, the division probably thinks about it first and foremost is the disease issue. If you're bringing a bunch of animals there together and something gets in them, then it's going to be way worse, you know, whether it's sheep or deer or elk. And like you mentioned, other states have drawn a hard line. Pretty much every other state, Western state, have drawn a hard line, and there's going to be some growing pains with it, and that's not going to be easy, but it's not like it can't be done.
Would we like to make a motion on adding verbiage? I mean, it seems like a really good first step. I don't think we want to really dip our toes in the whole baiting thing tonight, but
I'll take a stab.
Okay, great.
I'd like to make a motion, ask the division add verbiage to the proclamations for all of our hunting proclamations, you know, just as informational for hunters to know that they can't put salt near water on public land. They probably can't put it near water on a stream that runs through private land that it exits onto public land either.
I don't know if legally there's no restrictions. So just put it as a caution.
Just
a caution saying there's potential that minerals can leach the water and contaminate the water source. Just a precaution, just an educational precaution. Sorry, does that fit your...
Yeah, that
just I don't know if we can say they can't do it,
but
thank you. Just encourage,
we need to get this over with.
Okay, I'm going to try to attempt to.
Did you get that, Morgan? Or do we need to restate it? That works.
Sounds great. Do we have a second on that? So we have a motion by Kent Johnson. Do we have a second? We have a second by Jay Skyman. All in favor? I believe that's unanimous. Thank you. So do we have other motions? To, unless we want to take the whole thing and wrap it up, but we have other additional things. Eric.
I'll take a stab at it. make a motion that we accept the division's recommendations with the exceptions.
Let's only do, if we're going to do exceptions, let's do individual motion. Let's do individual. Let's not throw a bunch of them at one time. Sorry.
Thought you wanted to get this over.
I do, but let's just do one thing at a time. Just real quick.
I'll agree on the same exceptions.
Just make a motion on your exceptions.
I think if we do exceptions, then it's going to get really messy. So let's just do one thing at a time real quick.
All right, we're going to have to do this individually.
Sorry.
Make a motion that we approve the motion by Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife to make the Barney Top an archery-only unit this year, with the perception that it would go to an archery and primitive muzzleloader weapon hunt when the verbiage is cleaned up.
Okay. So I have a motion by Eric Luke to make Barney Top an archery-only hunt this year.
Or the coming year.
Do we want to add the other? I mean, I think with every, am I wrong, Covey, after every hunt you would monitor success rates. Can we just take it one step at a time?
Yeah, we got to go one step at a time.
I think we got to go one step at a time. Are you okay with that, Eric? Just making Barney Top an archery only?
Loaders in state law right now. It would be.
Are you okay with that? And then we look at.
Let me restate
that. Okay, great.
Let's make a motion to make the Barney Top an archery only unit.
Great. So I have a motion by Eric Luke to make Barney Top an archery-only unit for this year. Do I have a second on that? A second by Jace. All in favor? And we just, so it looks unanimous. Thank you. All right, great. Any other exceptions? Yeah. Any other motions? Great. Go.
Make a motion to ask the Wildlife Board to approve the division creating some archery-only bighorn sheep hunts for desert and Rocky Mountain bighorn, and the division would make the determination on which units are best suitable for that.
Okay, great. So I have a motion by Kent Johnson that the division make some archery-only bighorn sheep hunts. Is that okay if I just say that? Okay. A second on that? I have a second by Todd. All in favor? That's unanimous. I have a motion, and it might not get a second, and I'm okay with that. I have a motion to state that to not allow the use of air guns until they pay Pittman Robertson excise tax. I'm okay if it dies.
I'll entertain you.
Okay, I have a second on that by Kirk Blair. Am I allowed to make a motion?
No.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, great. So all in favor? I think 9, all opposed. I think I have some opposition. Really? You're going to oppose me, so I can't end up opposing
what
that.
Is it?
So I felt like I had to.
Was it 10 in favor and then just 1 opposed, Kent?
Okay.
Okay, excellent.
It has less to do with hunting in Pittman Robertson and more to do with free enterprise, in my opinion, thereof.
There you go. Okay. So are there any other minor motions? Eric?
I'll make a motion to ask the division to do away with the late elk hunt on the Dutton unit.
Okay, so I have a motion by Eric Luke to eliminate the late hunt on Mount Dutton unit. Do I have a second on that? Okay, so I do not have a second. Okay, I have a second by Helene Taylor. All in favor? I have two in favor, Eric and Helene. So the rest are opposed. Are you guys okay with that? Just doing it like that?
Opposed?
Okay. I have two in favor, so okay. The rest opposed. Maybe a final motion?
I have a question before I make another motion. Proposal was made to look at limiting the spike hunt on the book cliffs. What impact does that have on surrounding units? I know what Guy's saying, and I think a lot of us have that same concern all over in our own backyards. I guess one concern I would have is if it's limited, how many of those hunters are just going to go to other units and compound the problem of surrounding units?
Yeah. So one of the compromises that the division made, we have extreme quality in Utah for elk. There is no state in the union that has the quality of elk that we have. And when we did that, one of the compromises that we made with our constituents is that we would, when we made a lot more limited entry units, we said, okay, but we'll maintain spike hunting. There's a lot of good biology behind this, and I'm not going to get into all that, but the division views spike hunting as a good thing. We couldn't support eliminating spike hunting on a unit. It helps us on these limited entry units. It takes a long time to grow an animal. It helps us maintain the appropriate sex ratios. There's a lot of issues going on in the book cliffs. I know we have elk issues out there. A lot of it is population issues, probably more. But it's a unit where we've also got a lot of wildlife. We manage for trophy deer. We manage for trophy elk. We manage for bison. We have wild cow issues. We have wild horse issues. I think to point a finger at any spike hunt that harvests males is probably preemptive. There that looks at elk, deer, as well as the predators and their interactions and how that affects what's going on in the book cliffs. So that's a really long answer. The short answer is there are a lot of hunters that really value that spike hunt. And to have the quality we manage for, we have to provide some opportunity. It's the last family hunt, and we couldn't support getting rid of the spike hunt.
What is that management objective on the book list?
Population objective or age objective?
Age objective.
There's two. Are we still managing it separate, Clint? 7.5 to 8 for the roadless, and then. Eight for the roadless? Okay. Are you sure on that, Clint? Let's make sure that we get this right. I don't want to get on the record that we got this wrong.
So what does the data show that we're at? What's the average age killed there?
This last year, so not 2018, but the data that we have from 2017, it did drop a bit. But it also had the warmest November hunt we've ever had. That's why when we do this, we look at trend. So we have to look at the next couple of years to see what's going on. And at the end of the day, if we had to cut some limited entry opportunity to maintain family spike hunting, we're okay with that. That's just because I hunt spikes and somebody else hunts limited entry doesn't mean that their hunt is more important than a spike hunter's hunt.
Agreed. But we talk about the point creep, and we're all trying to do things to help that. cutting limited entry tags on a unit that were below objective.
With all the issues in the book cliff, so I don't know that cutting spike tags would even start to fix that. You know, you have wild cows all over, wild horses all over. It's
issue some of those tags. The welling
that's and beef eat better anyway, I'm telling you.
My name's Clint Sampson. I'm the biologist on the north end of the book cliffs. Glad to be down here. The age objective for the Bitter Creek side, the south side, is basically 6.5 to 7-year-old bulls is what we're shooting for there. The average, the 3-year average, not taking in account this last hunt, was a little over 7.5. And so we're still maintaining, you know, a fairly high age objective. And then in the roadless area, we manage that one for a little bit older bulls, 7.5 to 8-year-old bulls. And the 3-year average there is a little over 7.5, 7.6. So.
But still pretty much right at objective.
And when we started this spike hunt 10 years ago, 3 years ago, I expected to see a considerable dip in the age, because those 7.5-year-old bulls were being hunted as spikes. And granted, the spike hunt has gained fame and popularity, and we're having more people out there participating and hunting on the unit during the spike hunt. So maybe it's starting to catch up to us now, where we're killing more spikes than we did the first year of the spike hunt, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But overall, we probably will see a dip in the age class after this hunt in 2018, just due to a lot of things. You know, I'm sure the spike hunt plays a certain role in there too, but I mean, it was one of the hardest probably archery seasons I've ever seen out there. The opening weekend, it rained. So anybody that was sitting water got, you know, kind of hosed, literally. Rained as hard as it rained for months. And then it just got hot and dry all through the rifle. The muzzleloader hunters finally started to get some better weather to really kick them into the rut. But, yeah, I would expect it to kind of struggle. Last year, the main hunt that brought the age down was that late bull hunt in the roaded area. Really dropped the age there, but as you can see with the 3-year average, we're still kind of right there in objective. But it's something we're very mindful of.
Okay, let's put this one to bed. We still got a ways to go. Sorry.
There was one other thing that Guy brought up that might bear looking at. I'll go ahead and throw it out in form of a motion to move this along. But look at the multi-season elk hunts and remove those multi-season elk hunts from any unit that's not at or above objective.
Okay.
And I would make that in the form of a motion.
Okay, so we have a motion to eliminate the multi-season hunt for any unit that is under objective. Okay, do I have a second on that? And that's by Kent Johnson.
As a point of clarification, just because the division won't understand this, do you mean the age objective or population objective?
I think the point was age objective, wasn't it, Guy?
Age would probably be better for that, because the multi-season tags are killing older bulls.
Underage objective. Okay, do I have a second on that?
Bulls, they don't affect the population. That's not what's affecting the population.
Do I have a second on that? Right. For spike tags. Okay. So do I have a second on that? Does that mean clear?
I'll second it.
Okay, so I have a second by Jeff. All in favor?
Six.
Six in favor, all opposed. Do you want names? So I have in opposition Kirk, Dana, Darren, Eric.
Six and four, does that add up?
Did somebody not? Yours, did
yeah,
you
that's
vote?
Right.
Yeah, is that good?
Okay. Oh, did Garish vote or not?
Did you
abstain?
Vote?
Abstain.
Abstain. Okay, Garish abstain. Okay, great.
Passes
all right.
6-4.
So do we have a final motion? We got to wrap this up.
Make a motion we accept the rest of the division's proposal as presented.
Okay, so I have a motion by Eric Luke to accept the remainder of Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime as presented. Do I have a second on that? Second by Jace. All in favor? It's unanimous. Great. Okay, so next we have a presentation by Mike on CWMUs.
They do that every year.
Didn't you eat?
So,
I ate a salad too. I had to.
All right, thank you. So I'm Mike Wardle. I'm our Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator. I'll be giving our recommendations on CWMU and landowner associations. Before I get started, I need to let you know there was two mistakes in your memo as a RAC for this topic. So one thing that just came to our attention is CWMU season dates typically start on September 1st every year. In code, we are not allowed to start a hunt on a Sunday, and next year, September 1st is a Sunday. So in your hunt table, the season dates list, September 1st is the opening day. That's actually, we're recommending bumping that to August 31st, and then it will go to October 30th instead of October 31st. The other error was it on your memo, it states that there were no renewal applications for landowner associations. There was one renewal application. You'll see that here in this presentation. So for CWMUs, as a summary, we received 30 CWMU applications. Two of those were for new CWMUs, 16 renewals, and 12 changes. And for landowner association program, we received one renewal application and then one change application. I'll start with CWMUs. Just to give a brief overview of what the program is, if you're not familiar with it, this is a program for large tracts of private land. When they register for this program, they help us to reach our population and recreation objectives. And ultimately, the objective of the program is to preserve open space long term. Some of these properties are areas that could be developed, but it's an effort to try and keep that from development from happening and keep it in wildlife habitat. There are contiguous acreage requirements for deer and pronghorn. They have to have 5,000 acres. Elk and moose, it's 10,000 acres. And what happens is the CWMU is given permits, and those permits are split between the private landowners, and then a portion of them also go to the public. So for an example, if you look at the Weber Florence Creek in the northern region, they are given 7 bull moose permits. 4 of those go to the landowners, and then 3 go to the public through the public draw. So this slide is an overview of how many CWMUs we have statewide. Currently we have 126. We have over 2.6 million acres of private land enrolled. This is 2.6 million acres of private land where those landowners have an incentive to manage for wildlife, and our public hunters get access to private land for hunting. This slide shows an overview of the permit numbers that we are recommending. You'll see on the left column the species, middle column shows the number of private permits, and then the right column shows the number of public permits. So as I go through the individual recommendations, you're going to see 3 different application types. So you'll see a new application, which is an area of land that is requesting a new 3-year COR. They have not been a CWMU before. They're requesting to be one. Then you'll see renewals, where these landowners have been a CWMU, and they're through their current 3-year COR and are renewing for the next 3 years. And then you'll see changes, and that is a CWMU that's within their 3-year COR, but we are recommending changes to either season dates or permits. And I'm also, because there's a lot, I'm just going to highlight the changes from previous CORs. And so I'm going to talk about areas where we're increasing or decreasing permits, or where we are adding species, just to give you a little justification beforehand of why we make changes on CWMUs. A lot of it has to do with wildlife distribution. As we all know, wildlife do not distribute themselves evenly, especially in our perfect little boxes that we come up with on a map. A CWMU could change acreage, they could decrease or increase acreage, and we recommend accordingly. And then also quality. For our public hunters, if they draw a CWMU permit, it's a limited entry opportunity, and so we want that limited entry quality to be there. And then also to help us with our unit management objectives. We see this a lot with elk, especially in the northern region, and we heavily rely on CWMUs to help us reach population management objectives. With that, I'll get into the recommendations by region. So in the northern region, we had some renewal applications. You'll see the significant changes. We are recommending an increase in deer and elk permits on Junction Valley and adding moose to that CWMU. We're recommending decreasing pronghorn permits on Rabbit Creek CWMU. If there are questions on individual CWMUs, we can come back at the end as well, if I don't touch on them here. These are the last of the renewal applications for the northern region, and there were no significant permit changes from their previous COR. We did also have some change applications in the northern region, recommending decreasing deer permits on the Deseret and increasing pronghorn permits. We recommend increasing elk and deer permits on East Fork Chalk Creek, increasing elk on Ensign Ranch, decreasing turkey on Foley Ridge, and you'll see that zero there. That'll actually make it so we do not have turkey permits for Foley Ridge on Foley Ridge CWMU. And we're recommending adding deer to Jacobs Creek, recommending decreasing deer and elk permits on Lone Tree Tunnel Hollow, which used to be Lone Tree Taylor Hollow, and increasing elk permits on Mountaintop. Recommend increasing elk on North Peaks and then decreasing deer on Weber Florence Creek. So in the southern region, we had 3 renewal applications and there were no significant permit changes from their previous COR. We did have 1 change application in the southern region. This was for Pavon Ensign. And we recommend decreasing turkey permits there. We also had a new application. This CWMU would be called Heist. It's west of Cedar City and north of Enterprise. It would be for pronghorn and is over 9,000 acres. We're recommending 5 pronghorn permits there. In the northeastern region, we had 1 renewal application. We're recommending increasing deer and adding elk to the West Willow Creek Ranch CWMU. And the central region, an error was made in the Walsburg application last year when they renewed. They receive 1 moose permit per year, and so it switches off between going to the landowners and then to the public. So their previous COR, it went public, private, public, if that makes sense. And this COR, it should have gone private, public, private. But there was a mistake made in the application, and it wasn't switched. And so this current year, the permit went to the public hunter, and so we recommend having the moose permit go to the private hunter for the next 2 years, the remaining 2 years of their COR. And we also had a new application in the central region. This would be called Mountain Sky Ranch. This is up Spanish Fork Canyon. It'd be over 10,000 acres, and we're recommending deer and elk on that CWMU. In the southeastern region, we had 2 renewal applications, and we're recommending a decrease in deer permits on the JB Ranch. We also had 2 change applications. We recommend increasing elk permits on both Schofield Canyons and Spring Creek Dodge. That's all I have for CWMUs, and I'll get into the Landowner Association program now. So to give you a brief overview of what the LOA program is, the objective is to build tolerance for wildlife on private lands that lie within a limited entry unit. And the way this works is an association of landowners is formed that represents at least 50% of the private species habitat for that unit. And then that association receives buck and bull permits based on how many acres they have enrolled and how many available permits there is for the unit. So if you look at the Indian Peaks LOA, this is on the Southwest Desert. They have over 24,000 acres enrolled. There's over 900,000 acres of elk habitat on the unit. So they represent 3% of the elk habitat there, so they qualify for 3% of the permits, which comes to 4. So with that, this is the renewal application that was not included on your memo with the Oak Creek. They have requested 7 deer permits, and they qualify for 7, and so we're recommending 7 permits there. And then we had one change application, and this was for Indian Peaks LOA. They added acreage to where they qualify for one more permit, and we're making that recommendation. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. So do I have questions from the RAC?
I just have one real quick. When I noticed with your CWMUs, there was a bunch of reductions in turkeys on them. Are we having a problem with turkeys dying off in areas or something?
No, I think a lot of it, honestly, so we currently only have 2 turkey CWMUs statewide, and this recommendation will take that down to 1. So Foley Ridge will no longer be 1. I think a lot of it has to do with operators. A lot of operators just feel like it's not worth their time and effort, that there's just not enough money in it for them. So.
Did you go back to your northern region CWMU?
The renewals or changes?
Right there. So the mountaintop. They reduced acreage, but you're increasing 10 elk tags.
Yeah. Same with Ensign.
Yeah, so a lot of times, so permits aren't based off of, completely off of acreage numbers, right? One of the things I talked about in the beginning was wildlife distribution. I've seen times where CWMU might give up, you know, a 4,000 acre chunk here, but they add on 1,000 acres here. But that 1,000 acres has a lot more habitat and a lot more wildlife there. Specifically, I mean, it would be more of a question for the northern region folks, but in a lot of cases, like I say, it's not an acreage-based recommendation, would be my answer.
I didn't know that. I thought it was based on total number of acres.
It's something we consider, definitely.
Okay.
But yeah, it's not completely based on that. And I think the reason is not all acreage is created equal, if that makes sense.
Well, that's just in contrast to the LOAs, right?
Right.
Which is based on acreage of suitable habitat that's in private.
Right. And
looking at apples and oranges there.
Yeah. Well, and the difference, too, is LOA permits are valid for the entire unit, whereas a CWMU is only valid for that unit.
Okay. So if there's no more questions from the RAC, do I have any questions from the audience? We have no more. We have no comment cards from the audience, so comments from the RAC. I will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the CWMU management permit numbers.
Okay, so I have a motion by Todd Thorne to accept the CWMU management plan as presented. Do I have a second on that? I have a second by Jace. All in favor? Yes.
I have a conflict.
Okay.
Of interest.
Okay, so I have, and Garrish, are you in favor of that? And so I just have one, but you're not opposed, just abstaining?
Abstaining.
Okay, so Sue is abstaining. Okay, great. All right, thank you, Mike. So next we have Brian Christensen, or are you doing that, Mike? No? Do it, Brian. There you are. Thank you. Dedicated hunter rule amendments. You are going down.
Wait, I got a lot of questions. You should see my notes on this one.
We haven't gotten to the e-bikes, she says.
Oh, yeah. And that one, too.
We still realize our turn.
This is not law.
I know that. We all do. Exactly.
I'm already an hour under sleep.
Especially in the winter. Should have been asleep an hour ago. Exactly. Okay.
I can make this pretty quick.
Way to go.
I got an easy one. But if it makes you feel better, the Central Region one, I don't think I even got up till about 11:15, so we're doing 2 hours ahead of them. So I'm Brian Christensen. I'm the State Volunteer Services Coordinator and oversee the Dedicated Hunter Program as well. This is a pretty simple proposal, recommendations. Basically, a quick background is the Dedicated Hunter Program, for those not familiar, is a general season buck deer hunting program where a person applies just like they would a general season buck tag. They apply to be in this program. If they happen to draw into it, we allow them a 3-year time period where they have the unit that they drew and they can hunt archery, muzzleloader, and any legal weapon seasons. During that 3-year enrollment, they're limited to 2 harvests during those 3 years, and they get all that in exchange for a 32-hour service commitment to us that they do during that time frame. Right now there's about 9,000 dedicated hunters, and it seems to be growing. So, my purpose today is to propose these recommendations. Just basically they're simplifying the rule. We were making a couple minor corrections, and then anytime we get public input, dedicated hunter input, we like to consider that heavily. We talk about it. We try to figure out what works best for the division and the participants, and then when we can, we make changes to it. And then the last part here is that we've got a couple of procedures we'd like to improve that we think will be benefit for both participants and the division. So the first of these is a small change. Right now, dedicated hunters that draw, they're allowed to apply and draw a limited entry buck deer permit. And if they happen to draw that while they're in their 3-year program, we allow them the option to request a 1-year extension so that they can take full advantage of all 3 years. What we are lacking right now in the rule is any kind of deadline to have them request that. So it's open-ended. We need to tie up that little loophole and just have the opportunity to tell them they got to tell us by a certain amount of time. The second one's a little more substantial. We're currently dedicated hunters that draw. They get into the program. They need to do an ethics training course that's online, and then they can have their first permit. The second year, we require a minimum of those 16 service hours to be complete before they get their permit. And then again, the third year, another 16, making a total of 32. We are proposing that we go back to a method that we used, a structure we used for many, many years, where the participant gets in to the program and they need to complete 8 hours before they can have that first permit. And then 16 the following year, and then another 8 the third year. Now, these hours can be done at any time during their program, so they're not limited to that structure. They can do all 32 the first year if they want. But what this does for us, to go back to an old structure, is it gives us the opportunity to relieve some situations. Often dedicated hunters will get into this program and find that they have a life change, a serious medical situation, a job change. They move out of state. There's a lot of things that happen unexpectedly. And the way our rule works now, they can get upside down in their service credit hours. They can have a permit, and then they move out of state, or they're in the hospital or whatever. And we have to tell them they need to do 11 hours before they can get out. And often they can't do those hours. And so they're either forced to pay when they're in situations that they don't have the funds to do that, or they have to stay in the program and often end up not using those permits and until the very end, and then it gets even worse. And so this system, by changing it back to an 8 the first year, we can make it so that at any given point, a dedicated hunter will be eligible to withdraw. So whether if they get no permits, we're satisfied, they can withdraw formally without any other requirements. If they get 1 permit, we'll already know they had 8 service hours. And they can withdraw, we're satisfied with that. If they've gotten their second permit, we'll know they have already done 24 hours. That's a good place to be, and we'd be satisfied letting them out. So this new structure, we recognize it's a little more work up front for dedicated hunters after they draw until the first hunt to be proactive and have to get on to a good day full of service. But we know that it's going to relieve a lot of these other issues that we've encountered. And in addition to that, we also feel like it'll be a little more positive as far as getting the dedicated hunters more actively engaged up front. The system now, as it is, basically lets us, and I'm one of those dedicated hunters as well, lets us get into the program and kind of forget about it for about a year and a half. And I feel like having some hours up front will get people a little more proactive, a little more engaged in this program. And it also ends up reducing the number of holds that we call post-enrollment holds. And that's when a dedicated hunter currently under the structure joins the program, disappears, and then 3 years later finds out that they're being held accountable for all 32 hours, and they may have never have gotten a permit. The new proposal here, the recommendation, eliminates that problem. So that's what I have for you.
Thank you. So do I have questions from the RAC? Okay. Questions from the audience? We have no comment cards.
I do have a question.
Okay.
On the hours, is it limited on how many hours you could get for helping, like with a banquet or the expo? Is there a restriction on that currently?
We don't have limitations on hours for projects written into administrative rule. We do have limitations within the dedicated hunter's ability to administer itself. So we have a guideline that we use for those kinds of things. For banquets and fundraising, the expo, those kinds of events, we do limit dedicated hunters to earn 10. Walt, correct me, is it 12? 12, thank you. It's 12 hours per year on those types of things.
Per year or yeah. Per cycle?
It's per year, yeah. So in ways a dedicated hunter could participate in those types of events or those types of fundraising and get near all or all their hours if they do it during the right time frames.
For the second year, based on the proposal, they'd have to get
right.
More hours
yeah.
In a different manner.
Yeah, but if they participated in a 12-hour the first year, and those are a little more rare because there's not too many of those fundraiser banquets for conservation groups after May. There are some that still do some. But if they did that 12 after that time frame, and they'd be ahead for that second year and still be able to get their next 16, so it'd be okay. We work with those internally and not within the rules so that we can be more flexible.
No question, Darren?
I see that you said you had 9,000 participants.
Right.
Is there a cap to that, or is there a certain goal that, or...
There is a natural cap, and it used to be just 10,000 was the number. Now it's done by unit. We can have up to 15% of the deer permit quota be comprised of dedicated hunters. So if we had 100 on a particular unit, we could have 15 dedicated hunters. But that also incorporates last year's group and the year before that are still in. So okay. The number we open up each year changes. But in theory, you know, if we had 100,000 deer tags, we'd have 15,000 potential dedicated hunters.
Question. So there are no questions from the audience and no comments from the audience, so I'll take comments from the RAC. A motion.
I'll make a motion that we approve the division's recommendations as outlined.
Great. So I have a motion by Kirk Player to approve the motion on dedicated hunter rule amendments as presented. Do I have a second? I have a second by Garish Willis. All in favor? It is unanimous. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So our last item by Blair, waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments.
Doing great.
Yeah, the bikes I keep talking about.
The heart.
Maybe using my water. Getting around the lake.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Chair. So tonight I'll be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2019 through 2021 seasons. And before I jump into those, I want to just give you a brief background real quick on waterfowl populations across North America. This right here is our waterfowl survey data. You can see that we've dropped down from where we were the last couple years, but for the most part,
Duck populations remain well above the long-term average from where they've been over the last probably 60-plus years. Looking at them as individual species, you can see that everything went down a little bit as you compare it to last year. But in terms of the long-term average, those numbers on the right, all those species are pretty much well above their long-term average, other than camasback and scop, or pintails and scop. But everything else is at least 10% above its long-term average and doing really well. When you look at our other waterfowl populations, swans, Canada geese, and light geese, they too are doing great across North America. For the most part, they're all increasing, some quicker than others, but really we don't have any concerns with those populations either. And so getting into the recommendations, what we are proposing tonight is moving the waterfowl guidebook from a one-year cycle to a three-year cycle. This isn't something new. We've been doing it with Upland Game for quite a few years now, and it really works well for our bird regulations. Part of the reason why we're doing this is because we don't have a whole lot of control over our waterfowl regulations. A lot of these come directly to us from through the flyway process and then from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which dictate essentially what our bag and season limits can be. So we don't have a lot of flexibility there, and so moving it to a longer period of time really makes it a lot easier for all of us. We also are heavily monitoring our waterfowl populations. We have really good biological data, and so if something was to go awry over those 3 years, we'd be able to circle back and make adjustments as needed. But for the most part, it's just going to make it fewer meetings and more consistent for a longer period of time. And so what we'll be asking you guys to recommend tonight, it's not going to be specific seasons and bag limits for each one of these years. It's basically going to be to go with essentially what's the most liberal option provided to us each year by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so it's going to be approving the process rather than specific things. So I guess just keep that in mind as I work through this. And so for ducks, we set this based upon our seasons based upon the population of mallards in the western part of North America. We're essentially given four different options, everything from, or anything from a close season all the way up to a 107-day season, and a bag that would be zero all the way up to a bag of seven. We also have three species that have species-specific harvest strategies. They have similar things as going from a 0 days up to 107 and a zero bag all the way up to two or seven, depending on the species. And so the way that we would incorporate those, if we did have a season that was less than 107 days, is we would put the days on the tail front end of the in the northern zone and on the back end in the southern zone. And so if we had an 86-day season here, it would be the last 86 days of the general waterfowl season. As far as dates are concerned, our youth days are going to be 2 weeks before the opener in the northern and southern part of the state. Our waterfowl seasons will start in the first Saturday in October in the northern part of the state and the second or third Saturday in the southern part of the state. For the bag limits for ducks, mergansers, coots, snipe, and falconry would all be a maximum bag and possession limit that was given to us by the Fish and Wildlife Service, with the exception of wood ducks. And we've been doing conservation efforts for wood ducks for quite a few years now, trying to bolster their populations. And they are fairly susceptible to harvest in our state. And so because of that, we've had a two-bird bag for wood ducks for quite a few years now. Looking at our dark goose, our Canada goose areas, we're not recommending any changes to the zones that we currently have. We would be going with the maximum bag and possession limit given to us. Okay. For light geese, we'd have similar season dates to what we've had in the past, with also the maintaining the closure in Millard County to accommodate the light goose festival. There is one caveat here. In 2020, October 25th will fall on a Sunday, so we'll be opening the season a day later. That year. We also have a leap year in there, and so we open the season a day later for that as well. Because we're only given 107 days to hunt migratory birds, we have to make sure that we don't exceed those number of days. For swan seasons, that'll start on the first Saturday in October and run through the second Sunday in December. The permits will be allocated through the flyway and by the Fish and Wildlife Service. We are recommending that our swan harvest be allowed during our youth hunts this year, as well as we're recommending a small boundary change. This is up by Brigham City, essentially incorporating a little bit more area, making our boundary more definable. It would be a highway instead of the refuge boundary, which it currently is. We also have two rule changes we're recommending. One of them is to not allow electric bikes on WMAs. Most of the other RACs have received quite a few emails regarding this. And so we've got a lot of good feedback over the last three RACs that we've had. And this is something that we're probably going to circle back to and work with those groups on trying to come up with a better solution rather than an outright ban on those. So just keep that in mind as you move through your recommendation process. It hasn't been accepted by any of the other RACs, and so I guess do with it what you want. But we do intend to talk with those people and come back with something that will fit everybody else's needs. The other thing we're recommending as a rule change is a definition for INL Island hunt boundary. This is something that we've had in our proclamation for quite a few years now, and we're simply just trying to get it into the waterfowl rule now. And that's all I've got.
Thank you. So do I have questions from the RAC? Or, yes.
What was the purpose or the thought process, the reason for banning the electric bikes? I'm just curious.
For the most part, we're trying to just get out ahead of it. We struggled with this a couple of years ago, and at that point, technology was at a point where we felt fairly comfortable with electric bikes. Since then, there's been quite a few different advances in them to where they can go up to 60 miles an hour. Some of them have essentially a throttle, so they're more like a motorcycle than a bike. And so we felt like, from our perspective, it would be a lot easier to regulate them by just not allowing them at all. We currently don't allow motorized vehicles behind our closed gates, and so we felt like they were similar to a motorized vehicle than a bike. We've since, with these groups, we found that there's a lot of different regulations that can go along with those. There's lower classes of electric bikes that would probably meet our needs as well as the user's needs. So it's kind of what we've learned through the process. It's been kind of an evolving recommendation. So.
Okay.
Any other questions from the RAC? Do I have any questions from the audience? We don't have any comment cards, so comments from the RAC.
Yeah.
Yes.
With regard to the electric bikes, you know, I read all of the emails, and all of the emails I received were in favor of allowing them. But one thing I will put out as a comment and a caution is, and I think what the division was trying to do and is already thinking in this regard and trying to be out in front of it, is the technology will advance. And if you allow it, we're going to end up with, just like we've got with muzzleloaders now, what was originally intended as a primitive weapon season has now become the single-shot long-range rifle.
Right.
And that is my concern with them. What little bit of research I was able to do on them, the technology isn't that far ahead yet. They're fairly primitive yet. They're still mostly just a bicycle with an electric assist. But potential exists for this to become, well, most of us here can probably remember mopeds.
I would add one thing to that. As I was researching that a little bit, the one thing that comes to mind is these bad boy buggies, which are basically a side-by-side, but they're also an electric vehicle.
Right.
I don't know if the motor thing plays into that, but that's just something to be mindful of as you're going back to that drawing board.
And if you're going to stay in shape for that hunt when you're 85, you got to walk a little bit.
That's exactly right. I think you just go out and ban them, because when you're 80, you're going to have, that's the first time you're going to get a sheep or goat tag. But on the serious side to that, I mean, I don't think, my personal opinion, and I did get the emails and everything as well, is, I mean, you have to draw the line, and it's going to be a real slippery slope to split hairs like that. I mean, motorized is motorized. If you fall in line with what basically every other agency has done, and correct me if I'm wrong, Darren, but the Forest Service, the BLM, you can't take those on a trail unless it's a motorized trail. And so if you're going to say non-motorized, then there's a motor there. It's a power assist, but there's a motor. So I think you're not kicking anybody out. And I mean, there's not many hills on the WMAs anyway, so just pull your bike, because you're gonna need it later.
Okay. I'd like to echo those comments. But there is one exception. Utah Parks recognizes e-bikes as bicycles and not motorized bicycles. Okay. So to be consistent, the state should either draw the line somewhere. But I agree that e-bikes are motorized and they should be treated as motorized vehicles. And I'd like to pass that on to state parks too.
Okay, so can we entertain a motion?
I make a motion that we accept the division's recommendations as outlined.
Okay, I have a motion by Kirk Player to accept the division's recommendations on waterfowl hunt as outlined, and a second by Kent. All in favor?
I guess I was unclear. If we accept it now, is that accepting?
I think the yes.
Yeah, that's
accepting
it.
The ban on e-bikes. Okay, so all in favor? Unanimous? No, just and then all opposed? So I have one. I have Todd Thorne opposed.
You're going to be in trouble when you get that sheep tag.
I have to be. You're not being difficult. You're not being difficult.
Yes,
I'm
going to
do it.
Okay. And at this junction, we are adjourned. Nice job. Oh, you made